Davros, if you had created a virus in your laboratory, something contagious and infectious that killed on contact, a virus that would destroy all other forms of life, would you allow its use?
It is an interesting conjecture.
Would you do it?
The only living thing, a microscopic organism, reigning supreme. A fascinating idea.
But would you do it?
Yes. Yes. To hold in my hand a capsule that contained such power. To know that life and death on such a scale was my choice. To know that the tiny pressure on my thumb, enough to break the glass, would end everything. Yes. I would do it. That power would set me up above the gods. And through the Daleks, I shall have that power.
It's Friday, it's just after 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 8th of July 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. If you haven't already done it, good idea to change your bookmarks or whatever it is you use to pick up this stream before we start to talkradio.org.uk. Then if we have to change the stream again in the future, we will be able to change that for you. So you just have one place to bookmark, talkradio.org.uk for the stream. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner that's been gaslighting us all week with its military-grade psychological propaganda. And also, of course, that COVID medical misinformation where an estimated 60,000 Brits died unnecessarily because they weren't getting any ivermectin. And in fact, ivermectin was completely shut out of the way, wasn't it? So also creating a hostile environment, much of this press, for readers, listeners and viewers, although things do seem to be turning around slowly but surely, a little bit more honesty in our journalism, particularly for gypsies. That's one of the people being targeted at the moment. Of course, they're not paying any rent, which some people, certainly most of the Tory party and the landlord classes, hate that. Anyway, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, Bristol City Council, 203 contracts. I mean, it's almost as if this is a deliberate sabotage of the council rather than just laziness. 203 contracts, that's one in seven of all of the contracts where our public money is being spent by this city council, have not followed their own rules, say the auditors. This report's out in the Bristol Post this week. And the auditors are saying it's a matter of urgency to be addressed. Now, anyone that knows anything about auditors, if they say it's a matter of urgency, that's about as tough and rough as they get. So what's the value of these contracts that the council have just been allowing to roll over without seeing if we're getting any kind of value for money, or if they've broken the rules, whoever it is these subcontractors are, or simply not delivered anywhere near enough, or whatever they're supposed to do? Well, it's £69 million of our money which has been put into these contracts where they haven't been following their own rules on revising those contracts to see whether they're worth renewing. Lazy, isn't it? And particularly, it doesn't matter if you're being wined and dined by the people you're giving those contracts to. So we're going to be hearing from the deputy leader of the Conservative group here on Bristol City Council, because Mark Weston generally won't be interviewed. He doesn't seem to want to. He doesn't mind going on the BBC. He's the leader. But it's deputy leader Jeff Gollop joins us tonight. I also asked him yesterday what he thought of the resignation of Boris, whether he thought it was a timely thing, about time too, and also his thoughts about who should potentially replace him in the months and the years to come. And I suppose this is really about the Tory party choosing whoever it is they think is going to be a successful candidate to take them into the next general election in 2024. There are some I just call them Remainiacs in the Labour Party that think there must be a general election. No, there won't be a general election. Forget it, because the Conservative Party are not interested in throwing their whole party over the cliff, just Boris. And in part two, who is next after Boris? We have a good look at that and why. And I think we're going to have a bit of a surprise about who is maybe being able to predict now who it is the press are going to favour and who is potentially going to win, who it is the deep state want to take over from Boris and what kind of agenda they will have. So we do that in part two. Also, Mayor Rees here in Bristol, that's Marvin Rees for short, his controversial TED talk over in Canada, well, Vancouver. What did he actually say? Was it really worth 6,000 miles of emissions from his jet in order to say these things? So have a little listen to that. And if you can actually interpret what he's saying through the management speak gobbledygook, then you're doing pretty well. And whilst we're all talking about all this climate stuff, which Mayor Rees has been pushing very hard, global warming or climate change? Is it climate fakery, fraud? Or is it an emergency? We look at that too. Again, Prince Charles is in the Sunday Times. He seems to be in the Sunday Times most weeks these days with another fraud. This week, it's again to do with his little place up in Scotland taking money. But it's also connected. The Sunday Times expose this week looks at one of his failed eco projects and how much money has been poured down the drain by Prince Charles up in Scotland. What is he playing at? Because apparently this is his kind of secret headquarters he's got up there. And lots of scandals to do with the financing of it. So we have a good old look at that with the help of some rather nice people from Times Radio. He's a guy called Matt Chorley at Times Radio and Gabriel Pogrand at Times Radio, who did a fantastic piece about that, which I'll be putting up on our show page, all 25 minutes, about all of these scandals surrounding Prince Charles right now, at thisweek.org.uk later. Also, the American Stonehenge, the Georgia Guidestones. Someone decides they want to blow it up at 4 o'clock in the morning earlier this week. So will the Denver Airport murals be next? What is going on? And also, to wind up the show tonight, we have another clip from the wonderful Zev Zelenko. We had a couple of clips last week, but it's such a fascinating interview, that last one that he did, or one of the last ones anyway, we heard a bit from last week. We'll be hearing a little bit more from Zev. So, Iranian and Russian news has been cancelled, like happens in China. You remember that we used to have a go at the Chinese for shutting off the internet? Oh, well, we're doing it now. We don't want people reading the Russian news. We don't want people reading the Iranian news. We don't want people seeing it on their televisions. We don't want people reading the Lebanese news. Oh, my goodness. No, we don't want people reading the Syrian news. This is what the Nazis did in the Second World War. They cut off the ability of the German people to read what other countries around the world were saying about them. Now we're doing that to our own people. How clever we are. And first by the telecoms cartel being cancelled, and then by Ofcom too, cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here. Anyway, Martin Summers sitting patiently listening to me waffling on there and introducing tonight's show. I have to say, I completely called this wrong. I thought Boris was going to stay on and on and on. And then we saw on Thursday, on Wednesday afternoon and evening, an enormous avalanche of resignations, which even I hadn't been, well, I say even me, I get it wrong, of course I do. I hadn't been expecting at all. Were you expecting? Were you surprised?
Well, you get to a certain point when it's if not when, and I think we'd already reached that. And his mishandling of the Pincher affair was typical of the way he's mishandled previous googlies. Yeah, so I think that was what really.
You don't think he's been set up this time with Pincher, no?
Well, in a sense, the people who want him out, obviously, it was at the Carlton Club where this happened. This is where the Tories go to plot and stab each other in the back. So, obviously, those that didn't like Pincher is definitely a pro-Johnson loyalist and a whip. So if people see him misbehaving, they could have said nothing about it. What goes to the Carlton Club stays in the Carlton Club.
So you think maybe before the 1922 committee vote last month, they would have maybe said nothing about it. But after that 41% that he got, which isn't very much, is it?
Well, he got 41% of the Carlton Club is where all the Tory factions go to plot and plan. So Pincher obviously gets completely off his face and then does what he has apparently done in previous occasions. He tries to come on to the young staffers. And, of course, they could say nothing about it, but, you know, basically, that's a very foolish thing for him to do, isn't it? And those people who are Johnson's enemies, and presumably they would be in the room, immediately go and talk to the son about it.
Isn't this... sounds to me like this Pincher guy is someone from the Isolate, Inebriate, Penetrate branch of the Conservative Party.
Well, you may. I mean, it's all rather amusing in one way, but of course,
what I'm saying is groping does imply some sort of sexual advances.
Well, I mean, people have been saying Pincher by name, Pincher by nature, and apparently that is his nickname.
I think the dark side love all this stuff, don't they? Yeah, Pincher. Yeah, let's promote this guy. You know.
Well, I think the problem is it's not, you know, I mean,
James Brokenshire. I mean, you know, these names of MPs seem to do very well.
Well, he didn't. Brokenshire didn't do very well. He was in charge of Northern Ireland at one stage, which caused some raised eyebrows with his name. There's 50 something MPs under investigation for sexual assault allegations. This is part of the toxic culture of Westminster, where elderly blokes, whatever their sexuality, feel that the young staffers are fair game. And that's clearly, you know, that's pretty much, and it's almost like a sort of, you know, film If, about the private school rebellion or whatever. I mean, that's the culture of the Conservative Party. And it's very hierarchical, backstabbing. You know, it's not been an edifying sight for anybody at all.
This is really. I mean, I've heard. Actually, maybe before we hear it, we should have a listen to Keir Starmer and his efforts on Wednesday, because it's quite a painful listening back to the Wednesday coverage. Because Boris is clinging on, he's hanging on. People like me were stupid enough to think that he's going to stay on there for another year. All he needs to do is survive. He survived his 1922 committee confidence vote, so he can stay on till next summer, but it wasn't to be. But let's just have a listen to Prime Minister's questions this week, where Keir Starmer is doing everything he possibly can to stick the knife into Boris. I'm not sure he does a particularly good job of it, but let's have a listen anyway.
The only thing he's delivering is chaos. I started this session with a quote from the young victim in all this. How he froze when he was attacked. When I was prosecuting rapists, I heard that from victims all the time. Victims said they froze because it's not about sex, it's about power. Yes. And the power the disgraced government minister had was handed to him by that prime minister. Yes. And he's only in power because he's been propped up for months by a corrupted party defending the indefensible. So it's no longer a case about swapping the person at the top. Isn't it clear? The only way the country can get the fresh start it deserves is by getting rid of the lot of them.
Mr. Speaker, the difference between this...
We've got to get through Prime Minister's questions. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the difference between this government and that opposition is we have a plan and they do not. We're getting on. They want to focus on this type of issue, Mr. Speaker. We're going to get on with our jobs. We're going to control prices, Mr. Speaker, by not giving in to the union barons. They're paid by the union barons and they're proud of it. We were the first European country to arm the Ukrainians, Mr. Speaker. I'm proud of that. And those guys, Mr. Speaker, the party opposite, not only do they want to put Mr. Corbyn into number 10, the member is into North, but eight of them, including the shadow foreign secretary, the shadow deputy leader, and six others, voted to get rid of our independent nuclear deterrent, Mr. Speaker. Today we are cutting taxes, we're helping 500,000 people into work, and thanks to the strength of our economy, we're helping people up and down the country, and we are going to continue to deliver on the mandate I was given.
Well, they voted for nuclear to stop our nuclear deterrent. This is all starting to sound a bit banal, isn't it? And, of course, within 12 hours of that, he was gone. He's not obviously still around for a few months, but at least he's on the way out, and the Conservatives have started the process of electing a new leader.
Yeah, and obviously he didn't answer any of the main criticisms that were made of his personal behaviour. He just launched into a tirade about what he, you know, a travesty of what the Labour front bench actually represents. Because, of course, they are, in fact, very much the establishment, rather than regarded as no threat whatsoever by the powers that be.
So why is how's Labour come to this, Martin? I mean, you're a Labour Party member yourself.
Well, no,
and actually, you've confessed, haven't you? Terrible thing to do. You confessed to voting for Keir Starmer.
Well, because in actual fact, in our electoral system, Tony, we don't actually have the right choices. You've actually got to take basically pinch your nose and vote against what you don't want. Otherwise, you're going to get what you don't.
The whole of parliamentary democracy has come about, but like that, hasn't it? So when you're looking at the various candidates, you're thinking, well, this is the least bad. You know, none of them are really any good. I mean, this is different parties, and I'm sure that this is going to be the case when it comes to the Conservative leadership too. It's very difficult to see anybody. We'll see how it all goes, but it may be that, you know, we end up with two candidates, neither of which anyone would like to see running the country.
I think that's virtually guaranteed, Tony. I certainly wouldn't vote for either.
What's the difference between
the people that are likely to be selected?
It's not worked with Labour either, has it? It's all very well you pointing the finger and laughing at the Tories.
Well, look, the problem is the electoral system. In a PR system, you can vote for what you want, and then you've got to negotiate. In a first-past-the-post system, you've got to vote against what you don't want. And if you don't do that, you lose. It's brutal.
Can you just explain that a bit?
It's quite simple, because of the first-past-the-post system, you have to vote for the party which is best placed to defeat your political enemies or opponents. And if you don't do that, you lose. And, of course, in Northern Ireland, where they still have PR, they have PR for local elections and Westminster elections, what happened when Bobby Sands was elected as an MP is that the SDLP stood down to make sure that he couldn't, that all of the nationalist vote was consolidated behind him, and that other unionist parties on the unionist side stood down so that Ken McGuinness could get all of the unionist votes. And that's because they know how serious it is winning and losing, because it was a war. And this is the problem with first past the post. It's very adversarial. It's like a game of rugby. It's not like a game of chess.
Well, we've dealt a little bit with that. We're going to be talking about that more later. But our main story in part one is going to be to do with the privatisation of Bristol City Council and how Bristol actually seems to be leading the way in privatised corruption. A story by the local democracy, Adam Postens, who, by the way, has been banned by the mayor from his fortnightly press briefings, along with other local democracy reporters. These are people who are really at kind of the top of the tree, really, when it comes to local journalism. They're doing the nitty-gritty, that is covering council meetings, even things like licensing committee meetings. They do the stuff that the editors from the main newspapers, such as BBC, ITV, Bristol 24/7, the Bristol Post, don't see it commercially worthwhile to do those meetings. Well, Adam and his friends do, and they're paid by the licence fee payers a little bit to make sure that they do that, and they tend to be the best journalists in town, because what they're doing is the stuff which really makes a difference about, you know, how our money gets spent. Something like £400 million, £350 million, something like that, of our money this Bristol City Council we elect spends every year. But it turns out that something like a fifth of that money has been going on contracts where the contracts have been simply re-awarded and rolled over without any kind of proper checks being done to see if the City Council is getting value for money. So the Bristol City Council, I'll put a link up to this story on our show page, of course, at thisweek.org.uk. The officers broke the rules on awarding contracts for goods and services for more than 200 times to the value of £70 million last year, a report has revealed. That's an auditor's report. That's more than double the previous 12 months, and prompted external auditors to tell the authority, "You must address this issue as a matter of urgency. It's a sign of it could be a sign of irregularities and an increased risk of fraud." Well, we already know that there's been enormous irregularities with Bristol Energy. Something like £60 million of our money being poured down the drain by this Bristol City Council. Incompetent or corrupt, you decide. There were 203 occasions in 2021 to 22 where the re-tendering processes were not followed, officially called procurement breaches, which equates to 14% of all the contracts awarded by Bristol City Council. That's roughly one in seven. It compares with roughly half that amount last year. The council says an effective and transparent breaches process is in place. Well, it clearly isn't, Martin, is it? I mean, this is, you know, effectively where you've got things where the people who are subcontracted to do simple stuff like cleaning the drains, emptying the bins, etc., etc., are not doing what it says they have to do in that contract, and yet Bristol City Council is patting them on the back and rolling it over for another year.
Well, this is the first I've heard about this, so it's very hard to comment without knowing the detail, but I will point this out.
I can read a bit more detail.
Well,
now,
no, there's not much point in all,
all I've seen is this article here.
Yeah, well, the point I'll make is this. In the past, say the 1950s, all of these jobs would have been done by council employees, so there wouldn't have been a question about contracts and whether they were fulfilled or not. That culture of contracting out was put in by the Tories in the 1980s, and we should have kicked it out years ago. And it wasn't actually brilliant in the previous setup, but it was quite clear where the lines of responsibility lay. Everybody knew what was going on. The council employees were the people who did the jobs, and if they didn't do their job, then you knew who to complain to.
Well, Marvin is presiding over an increase in the risk of fraud and quite probably in the increase in fraud generally, dishing out contracts to mates, that sort of thing. In our experience, say the auditors, this is quoting directly from the report, as Adam does, high levels of breaches have been associated elsewhere with governance and procurement irregularities, and as such, the issue must be addressed as a matter of urgency. In a separate report to the committee, the huge rise is highlighted as a significant governance issue for the authority. Well, when they say, talk about governance, Martin, you're saying that how the councils used to do things in-house. Governance there was done by councillors. They would sit around and they would run a specific area of the council, and all of those meetings were open to the public, weren't they? They're not anymore.
Well, that's true, and also, of course, by having subcontractors in there. A friend of mine at the moment, she had a new boiler put in. She's a council tenant. She had a boiler put in by a subcontractor, and they didn't do a proper job. But because it was a subcontractor who put the boiler in, which had, you know, got the job from the council, she has got put in the position she's got to sue the subcontractors. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Well, it is ridiculous.
What happens, say, if it's an elderly, infirm lady, bedridden person?
She is quite elderly and infirm, so there you are. Now, the point is that all these things were done in-house previously for a reason. And, in fact, that's how Britain used to be run.
So maybe the new reason is that if you can dish out public money to your mates, then those mates will do you favours in return.
Well, what happened is the Tories brought this in, contracting out. You're not allowed to keep it in-house. You've got to contract stuff out. And that means, of course, it was a tremendous handout to all those small businesses that tend to vote Tory, and they got the contracts because they're the ones who can get contracts. Whereas, of course, when it was all done in-house, the people running it would have been public servants and, you know, with strong trade unions watching every thing they did. And therefore, they, you know, basically supported, you know, the whole structure supported continued Labour hegemony. They've done now is undermined all that so that, you know, people... everything's contracted out, it's all about making money,
we don't know
cutting
really,
corners.
We don't know exactly what's going on here, because this is what's happened with the council. It's like a great, you know, kind of iron curtain has come down around the city council. We're not allowed to know what goes on in there. But it could simply be that when it comes up for a contract being renewed or not being renewed, all that these contractors have to do is to find someone from the mayor's office, take them out for a lavish meal, or maybe even pay for them to have a holiday, and the contract just rolls over.
Those kind of allegations where people are saying that's a specific allegation. And unless you've
not
got,
really, is it? No, I'm saying it may be happening.
It may be happening. It may be happening, but there are actually some rules about stuff like that. What also may be happening.
You may not know about it.
No, you may not know about it. But what you don't know about, you can't really comment on, can you? What I will say is this. This quite more likely is that it's just easier to renew the contracts than to through the fine print and try and work out whether they've done it properly.
We will just have to, I suppose, stay
it's
on
just,
the two sides.
It's just
side,
an easy, thing, easy way
the
to do it.
Two sides of that divide, I on the corruption side and you on the laziness side. You're quite welcome to.
Yeah, but don't forget, if you're going to be renewing, looking at all these, the auditors are saying you've got to be looking.
It's trouble, isn't it? It's only our money.
Well, in that case...
Why don't they just let the councillors do it? They'll do this.
No, the councillors are supervisors of the whole council. They don't run the council, do they?
They don't That's know left anything to the about officers. These, they don't know the details of hardly any of these contracts because they're not being told anything.
No, that's because we've got an elected mayor system that was brought in by the Liberal Conservative Coalition based on what happens in the United States of America, and that's what happens in the United States of America. The mayors just dish out the contracts to their buttons.
And a glorious Labour mayor. If you believe that, you believe anything. Anyway, I did speak to Jeff Gollop, as I said yesterday, about this. So the basic facts are 1 in 7 of the contracts that the council's been putting out there and tendered for originally, but now has decided who they want to do these jobs, have been the rules about whether or not they're allowed to be renewed have been breached. They haven't re-tendered them when they are supposed to have at least have a look to see if they need to re-tender. They haven't bothered to do that. £70 million or so of public money involved, and they're being told by the auditors that you've got to do something about this as a matter of urgency, which is about as strong as the wording in audit reports gets.
My name's Jeff Gollop. I'm councillor for Westbury Trim and Henlees. I'm deputy leader of the Conservative group, and I'm also chair of the Resources Scrutiny Commission on the council.
Now, there's been a story in the Bristol Post this week, which is really pretty concerning for anybody paying their council tax, about £17 million, roughly, of contracts being awarded. The auditors, who've been looking through the books at the City Council, are saying that the council itself has not been following its own rules when it comes to awarding these contracts. And what bothers me is we know that in it's tempting for people to award contracts to their personal friends, and to, you know, these rules are there for a very important reason, that is to make sure that the public are getting value for money, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking, and actually when you read it in the context of the report and showing how many of these contracts are in breach, it really is frightening. My understanding is that it's more the fact the council isn't managing the contracts very well, in that what's happening is they don't seem to have a register of all the contracts that they have. And what happens is they suddenly discover they've got to renew the contract, so they extend it for a period of 12 months or 18 months until they can go through the proper procurement process. And in spite of backbench councillors like me keep asking where they are with the register, they keep coming up with a series of excuses as to why they haven't got the register. So my take on it is this is a sign of bad management. I've not heard any evidence to suggest there's anything worse than that, but that can always happen when there isn't proper processes in place.
Is that a significant amount of the council spending?
Yeah. I mean, huge chunk. When you consider that a very large proportion of what the council spends is on wages, so procurement is what it purchases is a huge item, and it's more controllable than the wages bill, in the sense that the wages is a fixed sum, and unless they have a major change in staffing numbers, it remains at a similar level, whereas procurement, the stuff it buys in, can vary massively. And at a time of high inflation, the need for the procurement to be working properly is even more important than it is in times when prices are relatively stable.
Well, I mean, you know, both when you and I were young, Jeff, almost all of these things were done in-house by the council. They were actually providing their own services. Now we're in a situation where, I mean, even things like cleaning the drains, things like that, yep, which is our own infrastructure that our previous generations have paid for and today are paying for, these are being done by outside businesses. The most important thing is that we know whether that stuff is being done properly. And what it seems that you may be saying to me now is that sometimes there really is no information available to the council when they're looking at renewing a contract as to whether these companies have been doing what they're supposed to be doing during that period.
Yeah, Yeah, it appears that it's not being managed. And if I sort of digress a little bit to sort of local issues, I've had issues with roads and pavements being poorly repaired when, and I suspect many other people across Bristol have, where the work isn't being done to the quality that it should be being done. Now, that means either the council is specifying a poor quality, which is bad news indeed, or it's not checking on the quality of the work before it pays the contractor. So it's actually about quality control procedures as well, how you make sure that you're actually getting value for money, getting what you pay for, the quality you should be getting, on time, and being done properly.
But these auditors, I'm not quite sure who the auditors are in this case, but what they're saying is that that this needs to be addressed as a matter of urgency, to quote them. Now, that's not... Yep. I spent several years on a board of a housing association looking at, which had a considerable budget, looking at auditor reports. I never saw anything quite that, with that quite... That's strong wording. This is very strong. This is sorted out now.
Yeah, but Tony, there were other things within that report that were just as shocking. So concerns about how the council spends its money on capital projects. So the things it builds. But also how it's spending money on special educational needs, capital programs and revenue, and also how it spends money on caring for old people. So an incredibly powerful report from the external auditors, and it's going to provide a lot of things for backbench councillors to be questioning. It's quite shocking that there is this much going wrong this far into an administration.
I'm glad to hear that he was saying what I was saying, which it looks as if it's just bad management. The suggestion that there is actually levels of corruption, I mean, that's another level. It's not saying that it doesn't happen. In Liverpool, for example, the whole council has been put into special measures because of the corruption of the previously elected mayor. But of course, that's bitterly resented in Liverpool because it's essentially the Tory government running the city. And when the election was held in Liverpool to replace the mayor, the Labour Party won the election. Local government can be extremely corrupt, but then national government became extremely corrupt, and national government's got more money to spend.
Okay, yeah. So we had a whole sort of tranche of supposedly brilliant things that this city council did under George Ferguson, which were then picked up by Bristol Mayor. We're talking about here about Bristol Energy, which was a complete disaster. We've also got Bristol Waste and also the housing company. So we had three businesses set up at arm's length. Why can't the council actually just manage these things directly themselves? Why do they have to set up these arm's length companies? Because the end result is that the city councillors that we elect, like people like Jeff there, they can't have a look at the books of these businesses. And it just seems to me that's the obvious reason they do it, in order to keep the corruption secret. It is corruption. I mean, £50 million down the drain is not an accident, especially when our present mayor, Marvin Rees, carried on pouring money down the drain for 4 years after it became obvious it was that's exactly what it was, a drain, a funnel to pour good money after bad into.
Well, they shouldn't be setting up arm's length companies to do anything. Council houses should be run by councils, but that is not the ideology of the neoliberals that have dominated British politics for the last 40 years.
Is it Labour neoliberals?
There's Labour neoliberals and there's Tory neoliberals. People, of an older generation will remember when city councils had real power. They housed most of the population. They ran the buses, and it wasn't necessarily all brilliant, but there was certainly no corruption involved in terms of people lining pockets. It might have been inefficiently managed. There were issues around
that. But it wasn't, was it? It was actually incredibly well managed. If you think about, say, for example, the 1960s and 70s, when Filton Airport was a major manufacturing plant for things like Concorde and other aircraft at the British Aircraft Corporation based up there, there were literally tens of thousands of employees that had to be got home across the city by bus every evening and on various shifts, and the bus company managed to do that efficiently. Made it work.
Well, yes, and what's changed since then is motorisation and all the other changes that have been brought in. The creation of the individualist philosophy in all of its manifestations.
Well, surely the biggest change is deindustrialisation.
Well, yes, because ultimately we deindustrialise as a result of obsessing about property prices and house prices. And, of course, in other better managed Northern European countries, that's not the way it's run. But we don't compare ourselves to other Northern European countries.
I think we should do. Many Northern European countries and Southern European countries have deindustrialised. Not Germany, but many of the others have. Well, actually, you know what's happened here is now China is making a lot of these things that we used to make in Europe. It's not just Britain.
No, it's not. Britain has suffered particularly of deindustrialisation compared to Germany and compared to other Northern European countries like Norway, Finland, Denmark. So we've done badly in terms of the league we're in, which is not, you know, the Premier League or whatever. Ultimately, deindustrialisation is to do with financialisation. Michael Hudson, the US economist, has discussed all of that. There are big issues here. And, you know, it's easy to pick up small stuff and miss the big stuff.
This might seem, you know, sort of boring going through auditing reports, Jeff, but I know, you know, both you and I share the concern about the way this money is, because after all, it is public money. Can you convince anybody? I don't know if you can. I may try as well, that it is actually quite an important matter, this, even though it seems it's a sort of story that you look at in the paper, you think, and you skim over it, this is boring.
Well, you know, I've been on council for a long time now, and When I first came on, I know that I had some interesting discussions with a long-standing Labour councillor who thought that I was a Conservative coming in and wanting to cut what the council spent. And it took me a year or two to convince her that what I actually wanted to do was to persuade the council to spend its money more wisely and more effectively so that it got better value for that money. And once I put that case, it became apparent that actually we could, even from different political parties, we could have the same agenda of trying to get value for money, and then we have the debate on what we spend the money on once we've got the efficiencies. Now, what this report tells us is that it's got worse, not better, and that is frightening, because, you know, even over the last 10 years the technology, the computer software that enables the managing of spending and of programs of activity have improved massively, so there is less excuse than ever for not doing this properly. Yeah. So, no, I certainly don't need any persuading. These reports are vitally important if the council is going to stand a chance of balancing its budget under the financial pressures that it's under.
Now, I can remember in 2018 the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees talking about how badly managed the budget had been by George Ferguson and making enormous cuts as a result, saying now, you know, within the next year or so, I'm bringing the council budget under control, where people in the past have simply not done that. Do you think he's succeeded?
Well, I believe the situation is as bad or worse than it was, because the external auditors are the same auditors that have been in place for the last 8 years. They haven't put in comments like this as a result of their audit, and this suggests that they have very serious concerns, and that. That is what worries me. The arguments about what happened in 2016 could go on forever. But the fact is, Marvin and his cabinet have been in position for 6 years. They can't blame George Ferguson or blame me or blame anybody from the previous administration. for things that are not working now.
Don't you think, I mean, even speaking as a Conservative, Jeff, that it would make sense to bring some of these various now, you know, taken out of the council's control and subcontracted out, back into council control? Would that help, do you think?
I think there needs to be a very careful look at whether the things that are outsourced are delivering as effectively as they should be. And, you know, I think it's each case you have to make a decision on the basis of the facts and the information. I think it's also interesting that, you know, as someone who advocated a lot of outsourcing of contracts, I do recognise that there are some of these contracts that are actually done less efficiently by the private sector than they were being done by the public sector. And I say I'm happy to look at each case on its merits.
Do you think some of these subcontractors might be thinking, looking at Bristol City Council, College Green, looking up at the City Hall and thinking these people are a bit of a soft touch?
I think in all honesty, in big organisations with large numbers of employees contracting things out, I think the contractors often think that. If you look at private businesses, the number of times that they go through a review, they decide to outsource a service to save money, and 5 years later there's a new manager in place and they decide they're going to bring it back in-house because they can save money, and 5 years later someone else will change their mind again. So I don't think public sector's alone in challenging. It actually depends on how good the managers are at managing the service they're delivering. And you can get good managers in-house, as is true of many of the city council's managers who do a fantastic job. But and you can get bad managers in the private sector. But it can go the other way around as well.
Well, Bristol City Council's top finance guy in the Conservative group and also deputy leader of the Conservatives, probably one of their longest-serving councillors, Martin, Jeff Gollop, actually amazingly saying, well, yes, I think maybe these contractors do look up at Bristol City Council, with whether it's George Ferguson or Marvin Rees has been in charge for the last 6 years running the show, and think these people are a soft touch. We just fleece them.
Well, what he said was that even in the private sector, big organisations are regarded by smaller organisations as potentially
when I suggested that they saw Bristol City Council as a soft touch under Marvin Rees, he agreed with me. He said yes.
Well, I did listen to what he said, and he was saying all big organisations, not just in the private or public sector. I mean, Jeff Gollop is a very middle of the road guy, and he's not necessarily completely in favour of privatisation or completely hostile to the public
sector.
Well,
he's definitely not. He's made it absolutely clear there that he's not definitely in favour of privatisation. He says everything needs to be looked at on its merits, whereas it does seem as if our present city council and the previous councils before that seem to want to outsource everything.
Well, don't forget the whole culture and environment within which local government works actually insists on contracting out for some things. You're not allowed to keep them in-house. And over time, of course, by having a contracting out culture and the change, you know, look at the changes in the culture and the health service with the creation of an NHS trust and so on, you move away from having a public sector with a public sector ethos into a sort of netherworld where everything is the same. So the sort of things you would do in the private sector, you do in the public sector and vice versa. And it's all about reaching targets, ticking boxes, achieving profits, if that's what your private sector companies want to do. But the culture of a public sector gets destroyed in that, where people, you know, take one for the team, do a little bit of extra, can always work with other people from other parts of the council to solve a problem. All of that goes gradually, gets destroyed.
So the other thing I spoke to him about specifically was, apart from Boris, which we'll hear in a minute, was the Clean Air Zone, which is about to come in Bristol. I don't know if you know, but the idea after bringing the congestion charge in London and then the ULEZ, I'm not even sure what that stands for, isn't it? Universal... Do you know what it stands for in London, Martin? This no. This emission charge? Emission zone.
I know what it is, yeah.
UL something. London emission zone. That must be something like that anyway. But anyway, so they've started bringing these things everywhere, and you're paying something like between 9 and £13 a day, literally to, what do you make of all of this? When you reverse out of your drive, turn the car around, put it back on the drive again the other way around because you need to load up the boot from the garage. You're not using it for another few days. That costs you £12.
Well, as I think Marvin Rees pointed out in one of the clips that you've used previously, it's actually a legal obligation on councils to bring these things in. So
so just a minute. It's not a legal obligation to start to bring a clean air zone in and to charge for it. Definitely not. No. What they have to do is to bring down the pollution. And they are doing that, and they've been doing that, and they've done very successfully in doing that. But they want to do this too. So this, to me, smacks of, we're going to tax you because we can. I mean, I know you think that as a socialist, that we should impose as many taxes as possible. And when the Conservatives start talking about, oh, we've got to reduce taxes, that's a terrible thing. But the interesting thing about this is this tax is falling on anybody that can't afford. I mean, because it's going to increase the bus fares because some of the buses are going to have to pay it. It's going to increase taxi fares for people bringing shopping back home or whatever. It's going to affect everybody except the super rich who can afford to buy a car made within the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, when we're talking about any kind of environmental or social problem, there is always the question of who's going to pay for whatever it is we're deciding to do. And that ultimately is the really $64,000 question, quite literally, isn't it? And ultimately, if we're going, at some point, there is going to have to be a pretty drastic change in the way we manage.
Well, I'll tell you who's not going to pay for it, Martin, and that is the people who have got £3 or 4 million in their bank account and can afford to buy a brand new Range Rover just like that.
Well, the answer to that is you've got to take the money off them at source by taxing their wealth or their land, and then you just provide free transport for everybody in the city.
If you're going to tax, why can't you just tax everybody? Because it's, this is
why tax everybody, Tony?
There's
only the rich should pay taxes. Income tax originally was perceived
as simply for the rich, but
ordinary
Rich,
people shouldn't
Marvin
pay it.
Rees doesn't. He agrees people on middle incomes and the poor are the only people that should pay the taxes. The rich should get off scot-free.
That's because he's not actually managing a national economy. He's got to balance the books as well in Bristol, where national governments don't have to.
He can balance the books, can't he, by taxing the super rich and their brand new cars. Chelsea tractors and the like.
Well,
but he doesn't seem to want to.
All right,
to do
well,
that.
Listen, I'm agnostic about these proposals.
Okay, you're also agnostic about the idea.
I don't know enough about them.
Are you agnostic about the idea that brand new cars shouldn't have to pay them?
Well, to be honest with you, what I would say about this is both Sadiq Khan and Marvin Rees have won elections with this in their manifesto.
This has nothing to do with it, is it?
It's in their manifesto.
They certainly were not saying that we're going to accept everyone except the super rich is going to have to pay these taxes,
well,
were they? When
okay.
they got elected,
right.
And also about disabled people, do you think they should have to pay these taxes? Right. Are you a socialist or not,
Tony? You can stand in the next election in Bristol to be the mayor.
Yes, answer the question. Are you a socialist or not?
I am a socialist.
Do you think disabled people should have to pay these taxes?
No, they shouldn't have to pay
those taxes. But why does Marvin Rees, the so-called Labour mayor, think that they should?
No. You could tweak it by saying disabled people don't have to pay it. There's various steps you could take.
So why
is Marvin Rees
not doing that? Why is Sadiq Khan not doing that?
You need to ask them. I'm not a member of it. I'm not even a Labour Party councillor.
They don't sound like socialists to me, is all I'm saying. Anyway, the Clean Air Zone has been announced this week. The actual start date is in November. This is, of course, road pricing. This is something that the Department for Transport have been wanting to do for a long, long time. The people who are actually behind these programmes is a company called Siemens. They were a Nazi company during the Second World War. They're a German electronics Technics company that have developed these special cameras that they've now put up around Bristol and other cities, which clock your number plates, dob you in and send you a £12 charge, whatever it is, and take that money out of your bank account for driving, you know, onto the street to turn your car around and back again, whatever it is you want to do. The other thing which is so absolutely perverse and insane about this particular tax, I mean, do you remember, Martin, when they introduced the congestion charge in London? Mm-hmm. There was quite a lot of fairly sensible work went on to make sure that it was that there was a decent road which people could use, a large road which ran around. I think it was the it was the inner ring road in central London, that so you could get round the zone. You didn't have to, you know, just avoid main road, so that the zone did not include the main road around the edge of the zone. Well, what these bright sparks here in Bristol have now done is they've included the main road round the edge of the zone in the zone itself. So if you try and get round the zone, you're going to have to go around all these little rat runs and tiny little residential streets and industrial estates and things to get round the zone. So that's another complete and utter mistake. Well, they haven't made a mistake here. They're just creating a hostile environment for car drivers. They just don't want people driving cars in the city. Why don't they just shut the city off to cars, except these super rich mates of theirs with their Chelsea tractors they bought last year for $50,000?
Well, you need to put that to them, Tony, not to me. I'm not responsible for these policies.
Well, I did a bit better than that, and I put them to Jeff Gollop, who's a Conservative deputy leader in Bristol City Council, as he talked to me yesterday about these clean air zones, which he's not at all in favour of.
It is a perverse tax, and it's also very strange, because a large part of the cost of implementing the clean air zone also includes the removal of it after a few years, because they believe it will have done its job. So it's a very, very strange thing. It's not quite just a tax on old cars, as I understand it, because some people who've bought relatively newer diesel cars are and spent a lot of money on them are potentially disadvantaged as well. And there are a number of things that look like cynical attempts to simply take more money from the charge by the way that the part of the portway is included, and effectively North and South Bristol are being divided, which is a bizarre thing to be doing when I've always believed we should be aiming for an inclusive city that brings north and south of the river closer together, not pushes further apart. I don't believe we're going to be able to change it now, because what the mayor has announced is the implementation date. But we have been objecting at each stage and still feel there are very, very many flaws. One that was brought to us by local businesses were those who will have to pay £100 a lorry a day to get them out of their depot in St. Phillips, whilst rail engines leave their diesel engines running for up to 10 or 12 hours a day just next door to their depots. And this is madness, because the diesel engines are producing far more pollution than the very efficient new lorries that many of those businesses are using. So I think it is extremely worrying. I recognise the quality of air in areas in the central Bristol area is not acceptable, and things do have to be done to improve that. But This is very much a sledgehammer approach to crack a nut, rather than something that could have been a lot more subtle and a lot more refined and potentially more effective.
I mean, I've been looking at some of the figures, and it does look that the general trend is for, particularly since the lockdowns and all the closures of the roads in the city centre, the narrowing of the roads, that actually the air quality is getting better anyway, and potentially we don't actually need this at all, and the whole justification for having a clean air zone has gone.
Yeah. Well, and also we were told that the threat of it was going to produce a
purchasing change in the minds of many people, which would in turn improve the air quality. Well, because it's kept being delayed, by the time it's implemented, which will be well over a year later than it was originally intended, many people will have changed their vehicles. So the threat is much less effective. The other thing, and you made the point about old vehicles. I mean, I've had residents approach me who have an old vehicle, which they know is relatively polluting, but which they use for one journey a week to drive out to drive the other side of the river to pick up a grandchild. Their choice to avoid paying £9 a day for using their car is to buy a new vehicle or a replacement vehicle. It qualifies. Now, the carbon emissions for the production of that vehicle are massively greater than would be expended by the old vehicle continuing to be used. So where, you know, we get really confusing outcomes from a policy that has a good intention actually produces all sorts of results that are not what was intended at all.
Yeah, maybe even more of a hostile environment for drivers, particularly those that can't afford to buy brand new cars. Doesn't sound really to me like a Labour policy at all.
There's a wider issue, though, Tony, as well. If you look at some of the tourist attractions around in the centre of Bristol, because the if you take the main buses that, say, First and Stagecoach operate, those will be compliant and won't have any penalty. But if you look at many of the companies outside Bristol that provide coaches for school trips that might come into the centre of Bristol, those buses would have to pay £100 to come into the zone. So if you look at SS Great Britain or We the Curious, you, for example, you could be in a situation where school trips, the cost of those will go up by £2 a head just to fund a coach bringing children into Bristol. Now, I don't think it takes much to work out that most of those schools are going to decide they will go somewhere else. And that actually is damaging our key tourist attractions. So that's another side effect, which I think is most unfortunate.
Jeff Gollop, Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
So, Martin, I don't know how much you were listening to that, but we're also seeing that the schools around the city are now saying that we won't be able to afford to have these trips because coaches won't be able to go into the city centre anymore, this sort of thing, having to pay £100 literally just to go a few hundred yards down a road into the zone and out of it again.
Well, as I said earlier, I'm not a councillor. I'm not responsible for the policy, and I'm actually agnostic about it. Obviously, something does need to be done about
pollution.
Will
you be happy to pay it? Yeah. Well, something is being done about pollution. Let's just be absolutely clear about this. This is exactly the same as been happening with the ULEZ in London. Is the air quality has been getting better anyway. So there is a very pretty good reason to say, well, what the hell is this tax all about? You're saying you're trying to improve the air quality. Just do nothing. You don't need to impose a tax, and if you do nothing, the air quality is getting better anyway.
Well, as I say, the council, in its wisdom, has decided to pursue this policy.
Money, isn't it? It's just about money.
It may be the case that because they've got they're strapped for cash, they see it as a cash cow.
Yes, maybe.
Because they should be getting more from the standard spending assessment
citizens.
From central government to do all the things they really need to do.
We've got all these lovely citizens who live in our city that like to move around our city, and so we can police them.
Well, there's inevitably going to be a case where councils have got statutory things to fulfil, like social care, which they haven't got the budget for, things like funding special needs kids. And one way to do that is to be entrepreneurial up with new taxes.
Another way to do it is not to pour £50 million of public money down the drain to Bristol Energy, for example.
Indeed. And as you know, week after week, we discuss these kind of
this
issues
council is
in
becoming
Bristol.
Parasitic, isn't it?
Well,
like a business.
Well, they're becoming, the local government has become stripped of its functions, and therefore becomes a kind of an entrepreneurial game rather than what it used to be, which is providing basic services and infrastructure to the people in the
city. The sooner this maniac mayor is out, the better, as far as I'm concerned. Jeff Gollop, final conversation with him was, I spoke to him yesterday, was about the resignation of Boris Johnson and whether he was surprised and who he thinks might be taking over.
As far as Boris resigning is concerned, that's now a relief. I supported him for a long time, but there comes a point when issues of credibility just mean that it's time for a change. As far as who's to succeed him, to be honest, I'm waiting to see who puts their name forward, and I'll weigh it up and make decisions then. But there's so much happened in the last 24 hours and so many judgments to be made on the way people have responded to the situation. So I think, like many other members of the party, we'll have a lot of thinking to do once the dust settles and it becomes apparent who the front runners are.
Look, you've wriggled out of that quite well, but is there anybody you think in the cabinet who would do a better job than Boris? And I mean, surely there must be one or two people you're looking at and thinking, well, that's the sort of person we want to see running the show.
Oh, I think to be honest, and there's a number of them. I mean, the former Chancellor has shown remarkable ability in the way he's dealt with financial issues, and I think he could be a real possibility. Bristol lad in terms of Sajid Javid would be a very good front runner. I have to say, Nadim Zawi, I was so impressed with his performance as the vaccine minister that, you know, I've rarely seen a government minister of any party be so hands-on and deliver such a remarkable result. So there's three people for starters that I'd be happy with, but I could add another three or four to that list as well. So, you know, I think there's some good quality candidates, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it develops. I just like it to move forward more quickly than the current proposed timeframe.
I mean, surely, you know, there needs to be something to sort of tide us over until, isn't it sensible to wait until the Tory conference for this? I mean, Boris is, there's nothing massive going to be happening in the next few months. And surely, you know, it's good to have a decent time for the various candidates to put forward their stalls.
Well, you say nothing massive is going to be happening, Tony. But I mean, if I look at the situation, we've got a war in the Ukraine where we need a strong and empowered leader in place. We've got an economic situation that is challenging, to say the least, and where there needs to be action to help those who simply can't afford to live in the current costs. So for me, I still stick by, I would ideally see a result sooner rather than later. But if we have to go with that time frame, then yeah, the more time people have to show the strength and quality of the candidates to both the party membership, but to voters as a whole, then that's got to be good.
As a man who spends more time than most of us looking at profit and loss accounts and balance sheets and this sort of thing, Jeff, have you got any specific things that you think it should be? You know, maybe some of the first things to do in order to address this cost of living crisis, as they call it. I mean, effectively, it's about people just having less and less disposable income all the time, and it's forcing the issue, isn't it? With things like the barristers going on strike, for goodness sake,
the
rail workers. What whereabouts do you think that the change needs to come first?
But you probably wouldn't expect to hear this coming from a Conservative, but for me, what I look at is we're all affected by inflation, but those who are most affected by it are those on the lowest levels of income and on benefits. And therefore, how they are given assistance to be able to afford the necessary things to enable them to live, and that includes heat and light and food, has got to be addressed. So, you know, it can't just be something that gives funding across the board to people on all levels of income. It's got to recognise those who are most in need. So that, to me, is the critical thing, that looking at how the benefit system works and how we target the relief to those who most need it and are who are most likely to spend it, because the financial situation that's likely to come about and the probable slowdown in the economy is nothing to do with the government. It's to do with the war and the effect on food and energy prices that the war has created. But the government has got to find ways of reducing the impact on those who most need it. So that's what I'd be prioritizing. It's easy to say that. I recognize the challenges that the new Chancellor's got are significant, and it will take him time to actually grasp the figures rather than come up with a few sort of superficial comments as I've just done.
Well, he's quite a self-effacing chap. That's Jeff Gollop, councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, and he's also the deputy leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council. And we're joined also now in the studio by David Miller, former professor David Miller from Bristol University, a sociology professor, and also one of the mentors behind or founders of something called Spinwatch, which is a, I think, wonderful little idea, which is where you can have a look at these so-called experts around the world and decide who it is that's funding them. Are they really an independent expert? Anyway, welcome, David.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be back.
And let's just pick up on what Jeff Gollop was saying there specifically, which is looking at this cost of living crisis. Is that what you call it? Because that's what everyone else is calling it. But it seems to me as if it's been something that's been brewing for quite a while, really.
Well, there's two aspects to it, isn't there? I mean, there's something that's been brewing for quite a while, which is the effect of Tory austerity policies, which everyone in the country knows about, surely. But, and that, of course, has then fed into the increase in the cost of oil and gas, which is already a dramatic impact on people's bills. And the second aspect to it, of course, is, I mean, what your interviewee there called the effect of the war. And that's not quite correct, is it? It's not the effect of the war, which is massively increasing food prices and oil and gas prices. It's the effect of the sanctions, which the EU have in their great wisdom imposed on Russia. And of course the effect of the sanctions has been just the opposite of what they intended them to be and what they thought would be the impact. It has led the ruble to appreciate against international currencies. It's the strongest it's been for years, and it's led many European countries to be unable to source oil and gas because there are no alternatives to Russian oil and gas. The Qataris or the Saudis cannot fill the gap, and it's going to lead to huge problems of oil and gas prices and huge problems of poverty and increased, if inevitably, increased class conflict as a specific result of the total inability for the EU, you know, an engine of neoliberal reform over the last 20 or 30 years, to understand how capitalism operates. You cannot sanction Russia with its oil and its gas and its wheat production, or Belarus, which produces the most agricultural fertilizers in the world, and think that that's not going to affect negatively the European economy.
You should be Viktor Orban's speechwriter, because this is exactly what he's been saying about his country. We are not going to cripple our own people by going along with this. And in fact, there's been all sorts of attempts by Brussels to twist his arm to go along with these sanctions and to really effectively punish his own people for Russia's invasion of the southeast of Ukraine. Or in fact, many people would say all they've done is they've intervened in what was a rather nasty civil war that was going on.
So, Viktor Orban, yes, but also the Serbs. Serbians are being pressured in the same way. They're trying to resist. They're trying to find a way through by pretending that they're going to go along with the sanctions and not really go along with the sanctions. The sanctions are an absolute disaster. disaster for every European economy. The Americans can get over it a little bit better because of their own oil and gas supplies, but every European economy which doesn't agree to buy in rubles will be crippled by this. I mean, it's an extraordinary act of sacrifice, self-sacrifice by the EU economies on behalf of Joe Biden. I mean, just extraordinary.
Well, it sounds like almost like masochism.
It is like masochism. I would have thought that, you know, the Americans pursuing a kind of, you know, U.S. imperialist approach would be in favour of this, but I wouldn't have thought that the EU, you know, a machine for neoliberal reform and privatisation that we've seen over the last 30 years, that they would have such a lack of understanding of how the system which they have ushered in operates. So it is masochism, and it's an incredible result. They started these sanctions thinking we'll bring down Putin, and the result is just the opposite.
Well, there's one thing really puzzles me about this, David, which you haven't really explained it there. I haven't heard Martin explain it either, and that is that these actual increases, particularly in the gas price increases, were announced last autumn. This is something which we were pre-warned, given 6 months pre-warning of this happening. At that point, the Russians hadn't invaded. They hadn't started their special military operation. The civil war was still going on down there with, thousands of people every year being killed by the Ukrainian army in these breakaway republics. And the other thing which happened last autumn was the mysterious withdrawal of the NATO troops from Afghanistan. Now, I look upon this in quite a cynical way and thinking, well, isn't it funny that we've suddenly got all these troops available to deploy in Europe if we need to? And we were also warned about the impending uprise. I mean, actually, it's fuel as well, isn't it? Because there was a supposed shortage of tanker drivers, which I fundamentally doubt that these oil companies cannot afford to pay people to drive their tankers during the party conference season, also last autumn. So it looks to me as if there's been a deliberate attempt to sort of blatant that they knew this was going to happen anyway. Managers of our economy, the big corporations, the banks, the energy companies, and yet they've done everything they can possible to try and blame it on the Russians here.
That's not my understanding. I mean, you have a different account of what happened last year.
Just a minute. That did happen last year.
It did, yeah.
The fuel prices went up dramatically during the party conference season, and when we were told, oh, there's not enough fuel to go around. This is the sort of thing that petrol companies, I'm told, do in developing countries. When they want to up the price, they just stop the supply for a while and they get an excuse to up the price a bit. And also, those troops did come home, didn't they?
That's true. But I'm not seeing the connection between those events and the subsequent effect of the sanctions, which I think is an additional increase to the cost, which will make it even much worse than it was. So I think there's two things going on there. I mean, you know, notwithstanding that you would want to produce some, I would want you to produce some evidence that links the two of them. I haven't any evidence that the two are linked at this moment. Anyhow, we certainly are seeing the result of the sanctions being that the fuel prices will massively increase, and that there will be profound immiseration across all European countries that don't pay in rubles, and that includes our country, of course.
Martin, what do you make of the if you were sitting in it's not Rishi Sunak anymore, is it? If you were in the Chancellor's at the Chancellor's desk, what would you be doing to sort this out? Because, for example, in France, they haven't had anywhere near such an uplift in the price of gas, for example. The French have got much more state control of the gas prices. Is it feasible for the British government to phone up BP and Shell and say, no, you're not putting these prices up?
Well, it isn't feasible in the same way as it is in France, but the bigger picture is still the bigger picture. The French aren't going to escape from this either. It is an extraordinary thing to see European countries, including Britain, essentially committing economic suicide, because that's what it is. And ultimately, it's going to lead probably to the breakup of the EU, and the Brexiteers may cheer at that, but the breakup of NATO is ultimately what's going to happen. The Germans, in the long run, have got to build a stable relationship with the Russians. That's always been the case. It's the tyranny of geography. And ultimately, that is going to be decisive, because in the end of the day, the policies that have been pursued are going to create a political crisis, not in Russia. In actual fact, United Russia are doing very well in the opinion polls inside Russia. They're not losing at all. It's the politicians in the West who are going to pay the price.
Well, we're going to be hearing a little bit from Boris's resignation speech. in a minute. But before that, from a chap called Naheem Zahawi. Now, he was the vaccines secretary or minister or whatever, and he was in the cabinet making sure that these vaccines were delivered, if that's what you call them. Most people just call them jabs of one sort or another. And there's actually some quite, you know, contention about whether they are actually vaccines in the traditional dictionary sense of the word. But anyway, he has gone on to great things, and he's one of the people who is definitely slated as a potential person to take over from Boris in this what will probably be 2 or 3 months of leadership contest. But let's have a listen now, because I love journalists like Nathan Lee at ITV News, because he's gotten off of his backside, probably told to do it by his editor, and he's managed to track Naheem Zahawi down at Wednesday lunchtime, and he managed to find him in the street. So he asked him a few basic questions about what is going on Wednesday lunchtime.
Mr. Zahawi, did you tell the Prime Minister to resign? You're going to launch your own leadership bid, Mr. Zahawi. Are you supporting the Prime Minister or not, Mr. Zahawi? What happened in number 10 today when you went there to see him, Mr. Zahawi? Are you going to launch your own leadership bid? Do you regret, sir, saying that you'll take the chance for the Exchequer job? I'm Nathan from ITV News. Do you regret saying that you'd be Chancellor of the Exchequer, Mr. Zahawi? Should the Prime Minister resign, Mr. Zahawi?
So that is the wonderful Nathan Lee from ITV News tracking down Naheem Zahawi in the street. Now, one thing I'll tell you as a journalist is you can often see almost a kind of schizophrenic transformation in the politician when they sit down in a studio when the cameras are rolling or the microphones are on. And, of course, they do not like to be caught out and like that and asked all these questions. And I'm wondering, David, what you make of this, because you've got some politicians who are able to answer questions in situations like that and to understand that actually they are on camera, the whole of the country is looking at them, and it looks rather bad if they just simply will not say anything, particularly as these are very pertinent questions which are likely to come out, you know, even further as this campaign goes on, such as why did you accept the job of Chancellor only to stab Boris in the back 5 minutes later? You know, it seems that you're playing a Machiavellian game here rather than actually doing your duty to run the country.
Well, of course it was a Machiavellian game. I mean, it reminds me of the choreographed resignations over Corbyn, the chicken queue, so-called chicken queue, after the Brexit referendum was announced. So, of course, this is choreographed. Of course, they've got a plan. Who knows what the plan is? We will see as time goes on what the plan is. But we've heard that Sunak has put his hat in the ring. We heard from your friend from Bristol Council there that he thought that the other candidates were, amongst them were Zahawi and also Sajid Javid. It's also been said, of course, that Priti Patel will be putting her hat in the ring. Who knows? But, I mean, already we have four candidates, none of whom are white. So we have, you know, the potential of a person of colour as the first Prime Minister, first time they've been Prime Minister of the UK. And of course that would be very interesting, because the papers would be alive with the talk of the renaissance of anti-racist Britain and all this kind of rubbish which they would try and present. But all of those four candidates are extremely interesting candidates, and of course have all sorts of demerits and demerits to them, notwithstanding the others that we could add to the list. I would hesitate to name who those would be, but we will see how this plays out. They've got a plan. There will be contending plans. There are contending factions of the elite who stand behind each of these candidates, and let's see how this goes.
I mean, I don't think that plans like the Pinchergate get kind of rolled out without at least a pretty powerful faction of the establishment deciding who they wanted to have in beforehand. Now, they think that this person is going to do as they're told, that they're going to bring, you know, the plan, whatever it is that they're up to, in. Martin, what do you make of the whole sort of process of how these things work? Because it seemed to me very much like, when it came to Tuesday, Wednesday this week, that someone somewhere had decided to press the button, the nuclear button on Boris, and to make sure that they had a plan to get rid of him. In other words, a scandal of some sort, which turned out to be the Pincher business, and that he's being jettisoned for a purpose. And it's not just that these events have just unfolded naturally.
Well, I think Boris Johnson thought that he would continue to be in power because they haven't got a clear direction. I mean, we're talking about economic policy. You've got Rishi Sunak basically flagging up that he wants to cut, he wants to go back to austerity, basically. That was his. So he's trying to make up for all the money that he spent during the pandemic, which actually made him quite popular.
That is interesting, isn't it? Because he was talking about the windfall tax, and it was him that has got this extra money to help with fuel over
there. Yeah, but I mean, he resisted the windfall tax. The pressure was coming from the Johnson camp for the windfall tax. You've got Tugendhat now.
Sorry, I thought it was the other way around. Anyway, no.
Yeah, well, the point is that the Tory party now has to decide whether it's going to basically say, we magic money tree, yeah, let's just print some money and get re-elected, which in actual fact is not irrational, either from their point of view or the country's point of view. It's actually probably quite sensible. But, of course, the funders of the Conservative Party, they want to see the austerity budgets, and they want to see the poor suffering and all the rest of it. And it's very hard for the Tory party in its current manifestation to remake itself as a centrist party, because there's too much ideology, frankly. They used to be a much less ideological party. I mean, we had Jeff Gollop on earlier. He's a very unideological Tory of the old school. He would have no problem saying, well, we're just going to have to spend some money here. But a lot of the others won't go there.
So another person to say they're going to stand before Boris actually said he was resigning. This is, we're going now to Wednesday evening. We just heard from Wednesday lunchtime. That's Naheem Zahawi. It was Suella Braverman, who's Attorney General, and she appeared on the Peston show. And Robert Peston, I do find him hilarious. He gets very nervous when he's asking a question that looks as if it's been fixed beforehand. And he kind of gives himself away that he's in on stuff. But anyway, Robert Peston asked Suella Braverman if she was considering standing if Boris were to resign.
Yes, I will. If there is a leadership contest, I will put my name into the ring. I love this country. My parents came here with absolutely nothing, and it was Britain that gave them hope, security and opportunity. And this country's afforded me incredible opportunities in education and in my career. And I owe a debt of gratitude to this country. And to serve as Prime Minister would be the greatest honour. So, yes, I will try.
And just to, what do you think, for the new leader, the first priority has to be?
There's many, many priorities, but I think fundamentally we need to deliver some proper tax cuts so that people can be dealing with the cost of living challenges in a more feasible way. We need to shrink the size of the state and cut government spending so we can curb inflation. We need to solve the problem of the boats across the channel. We need to stop a foreign court interfering in our domestic affairs. We need to make sure the Brexit opportunities are felt for everybody in this country. And lastly, we need to get rid of all of this woke rubbish and actually get back to a country where describing a man and a woman in terms of biology does not mean that you're going to lose your job.
So Suella Braverman as well. You know, many people are from ethnic minorities standing, it sounds like. But will the Conservative membership be behind them? Also, she's saying there, you know, that tax cuts are going to be the best way to sort out the cost of living crisis. I don't quite, you know, make that calculation. I don't understand.
Well, it's the opposite of what your Tory councillor said, isn't it? I mean, you know, the tax cuts will not do that. They will just advantage the rich, as is always the way.
I think what they're talking about tax cuts is the national insurance contribution increase to pay for social care. And that was a regressive tax to pay for social care. And, of course, the Tories, especially the red wall seat Tories, want to see that go. As I understand it, the Labour Party's position is they're not necessarily wedded to national insurance increases. It's a tax on workers. But, of course, they're none of them talking about what you've really got to do is rebuild the tax system to what it was in the 1950s, where the top rate of tax was 95% and inheritance tax was pretty brutal. And, of course, then we could afford to do all sorts of things.
We could. And we're going to hear a couple of clips from Boris's resignation speech in a minute. But I think before we do, let's hear from someone who I think should be Prime Minister, who's definitely not Keir Starmer. It's a guy called Mick Lynch. And in fact, there's quite a few people been saying this is the kind of voice we want to have at the top. So let's have a listen to him here now. This is him speaking last week at a... It was a rally for some mighty workers, and what the rail unions have been doing is trying to help mighty workers not to take over. This is some sort of big multinational of some sort, mighty, that brings in cheap labour in order to try and get them in to take over from railway workers' jobs. But the idea is, and what they've successfully done, is the rail unions are fighting with the mighty workers to actually get the mighty workers decent paying conditions like the other rail workers have got.
Keir Starmer and others, they're hesitating. I don't know why they're hesitating. If he could draw a crowd like this with what he says, he'd be doing well. There are demonstrations, spontaneous demonstrations and rallies like this one in Scotland, all over England, in Wales. Not just for railway workers, but for the very idea that we can organise ourselves and fight back against this suppression of wages, against the stripping out of contracts of employment and terms and conditions, about the robbery of our pension funds, and against the division that this Tory party and the bosses in this country are trying to promote in our society. And what do they say to us in these interviews? They say, how can your cleaners get a pay rise? Why do they deserve a pay rise? What do they think is going to happen if our people don't get a pay rise? Is it going to go to these mighty workers? Is it going to be transferred somehow from one set of workers to another? Well, I'll tell you what the answer is. The answer is a redistribution of wealth in this country. That's what we need. Prices are rampant. Inflation is rampant. But what else is rampant? Profit has never been higher. We've never had so many billionaires in this society. The super rich are getting richer and richer year after year. The workers are getting poorer year on year. And what do we say? We refuse to be poor anymore. That's what we need.
Well, that's it's a great thing for him to say, we refuse to be poor anymore, David. But is he in a position to make that happen?
Not by himself, but, you know, as you said a minute ago, I mean, the barristers come out, the railway workers come out, they're fighting for the mighty workers. And we will see massive increases in industrial action because of inflation and because people have got nowhere else to go. There is nowhere else to go but industrial action and working together and for organisation to redistribute the wealth. The wealth can only be redistributed, only will be redistributed, not by by Tories giving us tax cuts or breaks, but by industrial action by workers. That's the only way it'll happen.
Well, this is something I find a bit funny, looking at what's going on in the national scene with the railways, Martin, comparing it to the outsourcing here at Bristol City Council and the disaster that that's been, and the breaking of the rules over to, you know, how and when contracts should be renewed or not renewed. And, well, you know, if you get taken off for a nice slap-up meal one evening, then maybe you'll just roll the contract over and not bother to look at whether these private companies have actually done what they're supposed to be doing in terms of council services, and that is with the railway industry as well, because what's happened since privatisation of the railways is that you've got these train operating companies along with the companies that now actually own the rolling stock that the train operating companies have to hire these things from. They seem to be making the bulk of the money now on the railways, and actually very, very little, if any, in fact, over the last 3 years of those profits have been actually going to the workers that keep the railways going anymore, just the shareholders and the banks that own the actual rolling stock.
And, of course, the subsidy from central government to railways has massively increased since privatisation.
Oh, is that funny? Because those share dividends have increased too.
Well, that's right. So that's clearly, basically, what economists would call waste. And the neoliberal consensus in Britain over the last 40 years has led to a situation where we tolerate things that people of previous generation would have regarded as absurd. And that's the truth.
So anyway, I'll give you two a choice now. Would you like to hear a bit more Mick Lynch, or would you like to hear good old Boris?
I would always say Mick Lynch, wouldn't I?
Well, let's have Boris.
Let's have a bit more. No, we're going to have a bit more Mick Lynch. I was just testing you, Martin. I'm afraid you failed there. Anyway, let's have a listen to a little bit more Mick Lynch, the tail end of his speech that he did to these mighty workers in London, who are actually now joining with the rail unions in fighting for decent pay. And they're not allowing these, for example, cheap migrant labourers to undermine the pay and conditions of the railway workers by working with them rather than against them.
They want to make us redundant whenever it's convenient for them. They want to strip out our terms and conditions, just like at P&O. They're saying to us, either accept this new contract or go out the door. We're not having it. We negotiated those contracts, those terms and conditions, and we are going to defend them every step of the way. And they say, we can't afford to give you a pay rise. I've never heard such a load of nonsense in all my life. These men and women from Mighty, we've taken Mighty on at St Pancras, we've taken them on in King's Cross, we'll take them on in Paddington, we'll take them on anywhere that they come onto the railway. Because this is the method of super exploitation. Outsourcing is the biggest evil in the workplace in this country. All of these men and women working for Mighty and all these other outsourced companies are being ripped off and virtually enslaved by these companies. We're not going to have it any longer. You don't have to be a social scientist to work out who's getting these poor contracts. The black people, the migrant people, the people from minorities are suffering disproportionately. And we've got to stand up and say no to that structural racism. Every worker in the NHS, in the public services, in education, in care, in transport, should be on a single contract of employment. Common terms and conditions, common agreements on holidays, sick pay and pension. That's what we used to have, and that's what we want back. That's modernisation. That's where we want to go. All of you have the power. A wheel doesn't turn, a light doesn't go on without us. We create all of the wealth in this society. All of it. It's our labour that delivers the services, makes the goods, distributes them and gets them to the people. All we want is our fair share of that. The rich, the powerful have got to realise that we need redistribution, we need progressive taxation, we need minimum standards at work, we need a bill of rights for workers. That's what we need, so they can't fire and rehire. And I've got a message to people in our movement. Keir Starmer and others, they're hesitating. I don't know why they're hesitating. If he could draw a crowd like this with what he says, he'd be doing well. But I want him to be the Prime Minister. That's what we've got. He must win, but we've got to push him and persuade him to get into a position where he's in the front rank with you, all of you, helping us, assisting with us, identifying with our causes, identifying with equality in the workplace, identifying with unity. And we cannot be divided. Do not fall for the tricks of the media, trying to play a nurse against a railway worker, trying to play a cleaner off against a caterer. It's absolute nonsense. We are a rainbow. We come from all over the world. And everyone is welcome in this country who wants to earn their living. Nobody is illegal.
Yeah, so that's a final clip from Mick Lynch there, and his talk really aimed largely at these mighty workers who the railway workers are now working with to get them decent paying conditions, because the company Mighty is being employed by people like Network Rail and the train operating companies to come in and undercut the wages and the conditions of the existing rail workers. But rather than try and fight the other union, what they're saying is let's work together, which seems to be a pretty good approach. But, I mean, Martin, what we've got here, he's saying there, is what we need is progressive taxation. Well, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? But it's the opposite happening here in Bristol, with the rich being let off this air tax, for example. The opposite the Labour Party are actually bringing in. So is there any hope that someone like Keir Starmer will actually be on the front line with him, as he's suggesting there?
Well, Keir Starmer is obviously an establishment-oriented politician. and he's not in, you know, he's not necessarily
so
going
no.
to agree with, he's not
no.
going to necessarily agree with Mick Lynch.
Is Mick actually wasting his time trying to get Starmer on side?
No. No, he's what he said there is we've got to put pressure on him, which is exactly right. The other thing that strikes me about this is the way the trade union laws work, which forbids secondary action. And secondary action is, in fact, solidarity action. And in other parts of Europe, for example, railway workers who drive trains could go on strike to push up the wages of the cleaners, because they're allowed to take solidarity, right? You see, the Mighty, as an independent company, independent of Network Rail, if anybody who works for Network Rail takes strike action in support of Mighty, the union can then be sued and lose all of its assets.
Yes, but you see, Mighty can be unionised, as it largely is becoming
but I'm just
now,
saying the
and they
reaction,
can have their own vote, and then they can do something
yes,
in solidarity
at the same time,
with the
very
with the
difficult. The trade union laws probably need... I mean, a radical Labour government would change
here.
The trade
okay,
union laws.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the trade union laws aren't awkward and an obstacle. They are, of course, but if they have a ballot like the rail workers have done, the Mighty workers can do exactly the same, and they can be working together with
well,
them.
Well, there are ways round it.
That's what that
but
rally
in
is
the
about.
Past, really. when I was younger, people could walk off a job in solidarity with other people, and with no potentially with no comeback on them doing that.
Okay,
so we used to talk in the 1980s of having miners' strikes for the National Health Service in certain regions. I mean, you can't even talk about that now.
Well, you can talk about it.
We can talk about it, but in other parts,
anyway,
of the world, they can do it.
David Miller, whether you think Mick is wasting his time trying to get Starmer on side and get him in amongst the crowd there, maybe even giving him a platform to speak to these workers.
Well, he doesn't really mean that. I mean, he's putting pressure on him, isn't he? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, the party of the working class, the Labour Party, as it is supposed to be, is not representing the working class, isn't representing the have-nots, isn't representing people who've got no jobs. And you know, the only way for us to have progress in the society is to have a party which represents the interests of the working class. And so pressure needs to be brought to bear on the Labour Party. I mean, it's a very, very long and hard job, and the party has moved so far to the right that it will take a lot of action to do that. But, you know, we're entering a period of enhanced class conflict. And so the political calculations of even the most appalling Labour centrists, and there are very, very many of them, will have to change.
So we had a bizarre situation with Keir Starmer also being let off by the police this week. So we could have potentially had two resignations, as Martin was pointing out before we started the show, both of Boris and of Keir Starmer. But no, apparently he didn't break the rules, Martin.
Well, that was likely to be the conclusion, wasn't it?
I thought the opposite, actually. Looking at the rules and looking at what he was up to, I mean, they were having a little party, weren't they?
No, they were having a meal after an election campaign in a socially distanced way. Anyway, the Durham police will have to justify that. They've decided no case to answer. It was the Daily Mail that ran with all of this in order to play interference for their Prime Minister, Boris Johnson.
As it happened, Boris was the one that announced his resignation, and here is an excerpt from his speech that he made on Thursday morning.
If I have one insight into human beings, it is that genius and talent and enthusiasm and imagination are evenly distributed throughout the population, but opportunity is not. And that's why we must keep levelling up, keep unleashing the potential of every part of the United Kingdom. And if we can do that in this country, we will be the most prosperous in Europe. And in the last few days, I've tried to persuade my colleagues that it would be eccentric to change governments when we're delivering so much and when we have such a vast mandate and when we're actually only a handful of points behind in the polls, even in mid-term after quite a few months of pretty relentless sledging, and when the economic scene is so difficult domestically and internationally. And I regret not to have been successful in those arguments, and of course it's painful not to be able to see through so many ideas and projects myself. But as we've seen at Westminster, the herd instinct is powerful. When the herd moves, it moves. And my friends, in politics, no one is remotely indispensable. And our brilliant and Darwinian system will produce another leader equally committed to taking this country forward through tough times, not just helping families to get through it, but changing and improving the way we do things, cutting burdens on businesses and families, and yes, cutting taxes, because that is the way to generate the growth and the income we need to pay for great public services. And to that new leader, I say, whoever he or she may be, I say, I will give you as much support as I can. And to you, the British public, I know that there will be many people who are relieved, and perhaps quite a few who will also be disappointed. And I want you to know how sad I am to be giving up the best job in the world. But them's the breaks. I want to thank Carrie and our children, all members of my family who have had to put up with so much for so long. I want to thank the peerless British Civil Service for all the help and support that you have given our police, our emergency services, and of course our fantastic NHS, who at critical moment helped to extend my own period in office, as well as our armed services and our agencies that are so admired around the world, and our indefatigable Conservative Party members and supporters whose selfless campaigning makes our democracy possible.
So that's Boris, a little excerpt from his speech. I'll make sure I put the full speech, if you really want to hear it all, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, 10 minutes or so of it, finally throwing in the towel and triggering a, what, 3-4 month long Conservative Party leadership election. I personally was quite annoyed hearing all these people say, oh, we've got to have a general election. No, the Conservatives are not going to have a general election. Don't be silly. They have basically not got rid of Boris because he can't run the show. They've got rid of him simply because they don't want him to be the person to lead the party into the next general election. They see him as too toxic, so they don't need to do anything immediately. The next general election will be in 2024, and the Conservatives would be mad, and they're not going to have a general election before that, because they've got a great thumping majority. But anyway, what do you think of his little speech there, David?
Well, I thought it was interesting. I mean, the idea that there is a Darwinian system, which he must have so highly evolved that he got to the top of, is truly, truly extraordinary, isn't it? The other thing he says is that the talents are equally distributed amongst everyone in the society, and that's him making some kind of populist point, I guess. But of course, talents aren't equally distributed throughout the society. At the top of the society are people with no talent, usually, who have got there through corruption, lies, public school system, etc. People in general in the society have lots of talents, but people at the top, they're the ones with the least talents, and they should all be removed.
And here's the end of his speech, the great crescendo.
I've travelled to every part of the United Kingdom, and in addition to the beauty of our natural world, I found so many people possessed of such boundless British originality and so willing to tackle old problems in new ways that I know that even if things can sometimes seem dark now, our future together is golden. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Well, even a few little claps at the end there, amazingly. Martin, what do you make of his pitch? At least he's come out with something quite flowery there, hasn't he? It's not a dull thing to listen to, like someone like Theresa May waffling on in her rather dull style when she went, and most of the other politicians. So Boris has definitely got something. Maybe it's his journalistic background that many of the others haven't got, and he's done a fairly flowery speech, and positive. He's saying, look, you know, okay, so, you know, it's been dark, it's been difficult, but let's keep smiling.
Well, it is quite positive for him, because he's going to go on to be, you know, very wealthy, to be, you know, he's going to be looked after, a bit like Tony Blair. He'll be fine.
Hasn't he been looked after his whole life, actually?
Well, exactly.
Hasn't he?
He's going to carry on being looked after.
He was at the bullying
club. Can I just pick up a couple of things there? He goes on about his vast mandate. The last general election in this country, the Conservative Party got 43% of the vote. In no other European country, none of our neighbours, not in Ireland, not in France, not in Denmark, not in Norway, not in Germany, they would never have been a government, because they have a different electoral system in those countries. And the sense of entitlement of the Tory party to run the system. We got an 80-seat majority on 43% of the vote. That's why the Irish broke out of the British Isles in the 1920s. And ultimately, it's not the only thing that needs to change, but it's a very important change that needs to come. The idea that the minority, wealthy minority, should have the first right to decide whether they're going to be running the country. And of course, that is exactly why you end up with people like him, because there is no competition.
David, do you think that there is, you could at least say something positive about Boris in that his legacy is reasonably, he's at least talking himself up, even if very few other people are.
That silence indicates that no, I couldn't say anything positive about Boris. No, I mean, he's a joker. The question I would have really is what does this say about elite politics? So, I mean, the fact that someone like Boris Johnson can become prime minister shows the demise of the possibility of democratic politics in this country, much in the same way as the election of Donald Trump did in the US. So there is no sensible democratic discussion in this country anymore, and Boris is simply the symbol of that.
The leadership election will carry on, will chug on over the last few weeks. But as we've just been bringing up there, this whole idea of entitlement and privilege, I thought it'd be a good idea to have a look at Prince Charles specifically, because there has been yet another scandal. I say scandal because I look at these projects that Prince Charles has been doing, and particularly awarding people honours for cash, and thinking, well, if an MP was to do this, they'd be out. Is there any way to get rid of Prince Charles when he does things like this, awards someone a CBE for giving him a massive cash donation in a suitcase?
Well, no, there's not. I mean, you must be aware of this. The royal family, it doesn't get there by election. We don't have a republic. We have a head of state, which is passed down through the family line. I mean, it's a joke of a system. I don't know if you would agree with me on this, but there should be a republic, there should be democratic elections, and we should have a kind of voting system which would allow us to vote in people who have sensible politics.
Well, I would agree when it comes to Charles, definitely, looking at him. My interest is not in the system, it's in the person and the people running the show. So certain systems will bring about, for example, although I'm not a monarchist per se at all, I like to think that, for example, if somebody is, I look at Putin as being a kind of quasi-monarchical system. He's managed to get himself in the job. He then changed the rules to say that you can only be a president for a certain number of years. And it's almost as if he's created a kind of dynasty over there. So the problem with a monarch as against a president is that presidents are much easier to remove. They have these regular elections where there can be smear campaigns and things like that to get rid of them, as we've just seen over the last week or so with Boris and this Pincher affair. This kind of way can be used to get rid of them, coups effectively, but you can't do that with a monarchy. So you may get five monarchs in a row, like Henry VIII, who were complete despots, but every now and again it throws up a decent person who they can't get rid of. The establishment can't get rid of them.
You use the word coup. I mean, the real definition of the word coup is when you do get rid of someone like that by military action or by popular action. Yeah, of course. I mean, these things can happen.
But a coup is also a way of describing a way of getting rid of somebody by legal means or whatever. For example, Charles I was gotten rid of by a court put together by Parliament. The only thing is that we'd had a purge of Parliament, and only the MPs that wanted to have a trial of Charles I were left in order to vote for it. So a coup can happen in all sorts of different ways, can't it? It's not just a military
action. But you're talking about the difficulties that there are with media smear campaigns. Now, of course, if we were to have a democracy, we wouldn't have the media that we do. We'd have a proper democratically accountable media system. We wouldn't have the private media that we currently have. We would have much stronger regulation.
The BBC isn't private.
Much stronger regulation of the BBC, so they actually is able to properly report the world, as opposed to simply being jingoistic and propagandistic. So the media we have are not the media which serve democracy. And if we had to have a democracy of any sort, then the whole media system would have to change as well.
Well, we've seen, for example, with Ofcom banning these channels. I mentioned this right at the very start of the show before you were here, David, which is that we're now seeing, for example, the blocking of Russia Today and of other state-run Russian services such as Sputnik. by IP addresses. Now, this is something, if you go back 3 or 4 years, we were criticising the Chinese for doing this. We're now doing it ourselves.
Sure. Well, I mean, as you probably know, I produce a programme called Palestine Declassified on Press TV, which is banned in this country. And I've had my Twitter account in the last couple of weeks labelled as Iran state-affiliated media. It's my personal Twitter account. I do a bit of work for them every week. I'm not employed by them. But nevertheless, we are in that position. Ofcom is not a media regulator intended to regulate media for democratic reasons. It's there to regulate the market in the interests of the market. So, you know, the whole of this system needs to be collapsed. It's not just the democratic voting system, but all of the media system. In fact, the entire way in which our society operates needs to change.
We've got a weird thing going on at the moment with the Murdoch press, because I've seen actually Rupert Murdoch's publications challenging the government and challenging authority in a way that I've never... I mean, I spent most of my life campaigning against Murdoch's, particularly after Wapping, and I know you did too, Martin. Do you want to just say something about what Wapping was about? Because this was the 1980s Thatcher government with Rupert Murdoch smashing the print unions, and you were there, weren't you?
Well, I went to the demonstrations and I chatted to the people who were there, because obviously I was living in London at the time, and lots of Londoners did. Well, he just got rid of his existing workforce. And, of course, because they went on strike against what he was doing, he didn't have to pay him any redundancy pay or anything. And, of course, there was a big issue.
Is this the NGA?
It was the NGA and SOGAT, who were the less skilled people. The NGA were more...
So we know about the miners' strike, but were the unions infiltrated? Well, the NGA,
during the miners' strike, they gave a substantial chunk of their pay every month to the miners. And then, of course, lots of miners came down to support them on their picket line when they were kicked out of Fleet Street.
But were the print unions infiltrated in the similar way to the miners?
Undoubtedly the case. I mean, we know far more now. We always suspected those who were involved in trade union and left-wing politics that we were being infiltrated, that people were basically spies. That was fairly common knowledge. But the evidence is now overwhelming that indeed was the case.
What do you know about this, David? Because it was quite an important moment for the press, wasn't it? Because you used to have a situation where, I mean, it's maybe idealising it, but I've heard this from 1970s print workers in Bristol, that for example, the editors often didn't get involved in the printing of a story. A journalist would hand it over to a print worker. The journalist, once the type had been set in hot metal, the journalist would be asked to come down into the print room and then have a look at a reverse version of their article. They'd sign it off and off it would go. The editor wasn't involved. It was a journalist and a print worker that made the news there.
Well, that's an age ago, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't happen
anymore.
Well,
this is pre-Murdoch. This is the pre-Murdoch era.
Well, I mean, look, there were spies inside the NUM during the miners' strike. There's been infiltrators in every big trade union. There are infiltrators in every big and small left-wing organisation. We've seen this in the Spy Cops inquiry, which is still going on, and more people are now becoming participants in this, because it's been revealed that they've been spied on, that their organisation has been spied on. They have been riddled with spies, and this is special branch spies. We're not even talking about MI5 and MI6. We're talking about the special branch, which of course is closely connected to MI5. Never mind about corporate spies. I mean, there's the classic case where this first became visible, really, was...
So hang on, just stop you a second, but we're talking here about potentially Rupert Murdoch might have his own spies in there as well as the secret state.
Well, this is the example I was wanting to give. I mean, the example of London Greenpeace, the organisation not connected to the bigger Greenpeace organisation, which had put out this leaflet about McDonald's.
Oh, yeah.
And they had, you know, little meetings every month or so in above a bookshop in just beside King's Cross. And in the meetings, there would be corporate spies. And there were so many corporate spies employed by McDonald's that they were spying on each other. So they would notice that there was someone new at the meeting who had newly ripped jeans, and they were a bit suspicious about that. And that was the other spies that the press spies
So did they ever have votes at these meetings? Because one does wonder whether the spies were
they had two sets of corporate spies. They are both funded by McDonald's. And they also had special branch infiltrators. So there's a guy called Bob Lambert who was subsequently revealed as being a special branch infiltrator. He allegedly wrote the leaflet which got them sued in the first place. So, I mean, you had special branch, you had corporate spies, and these were meetings of 10, 15, 20 people. So you could, on occasion, have a majority of spies at such meetings.
Oh, gosh, unbelievable, isn't it? Anyway, Murdoch, with his work on talk radio, for example, seems to have been in quite well. And of course, with Fox News and Tucker Carlson winkling out these suspicions about the lab in Wuhan doing an extremely good job in investigating, the only international media really doing this, apart from, well, certainly in the West anyway, a Murdoch paper. And I know, Martin, you were mentioning to me someone called Jeffrey Sachs, who is also now coming along and saying, well, we believe that it could have been, the COVID could have been a manufactured bioweapon over in Wuhan too.
In Wuhan.
No, where?
He said in the United States.
And then maybe flown over there?
Well, yes, but don't forget that DARPA were the investors in the gain of function research in the Wuhan lab.
So who
and
is
DARPA
this?
Is the Pentagon.
Who is this Jeffrey Sachs guy?
Well, Jeffrey Sachs is a senior economist. He's well known in economic circles and is probably most famous for being the guy who persuaded Gaidar in Russia to pursue the super Big Bang philosophy when Yeltsin came to power. And of course that was a disaster. And Sachs also is come out, you may be interested to know, David, opposing the war in the Ukraine, saying it's started by the West. So he's quite an establishment figure, but he's got some radical ideals and credentials. And what he subsequently said about the Big Bang privatization program in Russia was that I always said it would never work without a Marshall Plan from the West. So he's kind of covered himself there. But it was stupid. I mean, they shouldn't have done it. I think there was, I was working in the Eastern Europe at the time, sort of in a periphery. You know, I used to work for the New Economics Foundation, so we were critical of all of these things. And we were trying to work out what was going on.
It doesn't seem to be quite so critical these days.
Well, no, these days they've become a bigger organisation. They were a very small organisation when I worked for them, and they were quite very green in every sense. So they didn't really, you know, we had to develop a kind of what we thought was going on in Eastern Europe, because people didn't know. You know, we had to find out what was going on. I think it's interesting that Sachs has said this, because it's been picked up. He did it in a meeting in Madrid around the NATO conference. So he wasn't actually in the conference. It was something he'd said in Madrid. And it has been reported in some places, but friends of mine have tried to put it up on Facebook, and it's been immediately, they won't put it up. And that's because he is such a relatively establishment figure. And if he starts saying, well, actually, this looks as if it comes from a US laboratory, the way he's finessing it is he's saying it looks like it might be an accidental leak from a US laboratory, which, of course, he's an academic and so on. He's got to be careful what he says.
Okay, anyway,
but of course, the implication is that it's not accidental.
What do you make of the whole COVID plandemic, David, and its origins? I could call it plandemic, do you?
I wouldn't know. I think that that we face a huge mobilisation, have faced a huge mobilisation against, on the one hand, Russia in the last few years, and now increasingly against China. So anything that you hear about Russia or China, take with a pinch of salt. Doesn't mean that the Russians or the Chinese don't do bad things, that there's not bad things happening in Xinjiang. But let's take it with a pinch of salt. So, I mean, this whole question about DARPA and about the biolabs, I mean, the biolabs in the Ukraine, I mean, I saw the stuff at the time, the Russians saying that there were these biolabs, and everyone going, no, that can't possibly be. This is Russian propaganda. It's Putin talking points. And, of course, you know, the documents were all online already. We all, you know, anyone who had a Google connection and thought to look for it could find the documents and the contracts for these biolabs. And, of course, 6 weeks later, the Pentagon admits that there were there were biolabs. I tweeted about this, and I was really surprised to see that like thousands and thousands of people retweeted it, because it was a big surprise to them that there were biolabs. Now, of course, the question is, were these biolabs making dangerous pathogens for health reasons, as the Pentagon insists, or for war reasons?
Why do you make a dangerous pathogen for health reasons?
Well, that's the Pentagon's line, right?
The only point of making a dangerous pathogen is for unhealthy. And they still make you unhealthy.
You might argue that. I mean, obviously, this is the Pentagon that's doing this. This is not the Department of Health of the US. So yeah, I mean, there are military purposes for these things, right? Who knows exactly what they are? But the allegations are that they have made dangerous pathogens in order specifically to racially target them. That's the big allegation, isn't it? I mean, I'm agnostic on on all of that so far. But, you know, these labs existed and they were doing the research they were doing. And clearly they can be, as Sachs has been saying, they can be accidental leaks from such things, as well as, you know, potentially not accidental leaks.
Well, he's on the board of The Lancet. He's an economist, but he's on the board of The Lancet, so he's been involved looking into all of this all along. He said, he's saying, well, look, the evidence is that they have been tweaked, that they are, you know, that the COVID was tweaked, and so on. And Diliana Gatasheva, the Bulgarian journalist who we've had on the show, she uncovered in 2018 all the stuff about the biolabs in Ukraine and in Georgia.
That's right.
And, of course, the suspicion of the Russian intelligence services and the Chinese intelligence services, because they piled in immediately as soon as this came out and said, hang on a minute, we've got questions about this as well. Yeah. They fear that biological warfare agents have been developed. And, of course, a biological warfare agent isn't necessarily designed to kill everybody. It's designed to mess up your economy if you manage it wrong.
Yeah.
That's what the point would be.
Have we managed it wrong?
In this country, yes.
You think we should have had constant lockdowns, don't you?
No, I think we should have locked down properly like they did in China and New Zealand.
And what's that? They're still locking down over in China, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. And their economy is growing, Tony, as is going down the drain.
Although it does look as if maybe they're locking down in China in order to cover a kind of trade embargo, that they're letting less and less trade come over to the West, and also to drill their population for potential real bio warfare in the future.
That's more right. Why take the chance if that's what you suspect?
What do you make of these relations with China? And do you think that their lockdown policy has been too harsh? Because they're still doing them over there, aren't they? Entire cities of millions of people.
I think the important thing to think about in relation to China is the question of the alleged Chinese threat. I mean, we're in a period where we're in this conflict, this proxy war in Ukraine, and of course, you know, the worry that NATO has is that the Russians will push into the arms of the Chinese. Of course, that is what will happen, and is happening, and we're seeing the emergence of a new bloc, and effectively the collapse of the US empire. I mean, that's the more important question, it seems to me, in the current period, is what happens in relation to China and Russia. And we've just seen the Iranians announcing that they've now done the experiments of transferring goods from Russia through Iran down to India. Now that's a completely alternative way in which goods will be transferred. And this is the
Russia, Iran, India.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's called the North Corridor, isn't it?
North Corridor. Yeah.
Can it not just go straight from Russia to India directly? Why does it have to go down to Persia?
The route is through the Suez Canal.
Oh, right.
And this is way cheaper and way quicker than through the Suez Canal. So we're already seeing the realignment. We're seeing, you know, the prospect of an alternative reserve currency instead of the dollar, the ruble appreciating, the Chinese, the Indians, even the BRICS countries, the South Africans, the Brazilians, Iran applying to join BRICS. We're heading into an era of multipolarity, which is the unanticipated consequence for the West of the Ukraine adventure.
Well, we had Mark Sloboda, who's an American ex-nuclear military serviceman, worked in the US, and then he's now based at Moscow State University teaching international relations. Talk about something. He said he sees this as the great decoupling.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that this is a moment where things radically change.
This is the sanctions we're talking about.
The extreme sanctions and the immediate blowback that there's from that. I think it's the same, really, in global terms, as what happened in this country in 1956, when this country conspired with France and the Israelis to invade Egypt and to take Suez. And the Americans just stepped in and said, no, you're not going to do that. And that was the moment which everyone in Britain, in the power structure, realised that the British Empire was over, that everything was finished, that the Americans were in charge. And we're now seeing the same kind of moment. I mean, the Americans are now realising, you know, that they are finished. I mean, the whole way in which the whole Ukraine thing has happened, it means that they face decline. And people say to me, well, they'll in decline, they'll lash out. They can lash out if they want. They haven't got the capability to defeat the Russians in a direct military confrontation. It's an extraordinary weakness.
I broadly agree with that, yeah. It's a potentially dangerous moment because, of course, there's so many things to go wrong here. And if if you look at history, the likelihood is that these criminal elites will do final criminal things because that's the way they operate. But I think what is good is that in you've got a modernised system in Russia. I mean, it's been a huge struggle for the Russians to create an effective democratic system. It's not an entirely democratic system, but it's more democratic than in the United States, for example. It just is. And that's because it was created later. It's a modern system that's been created since the collapse of the economy in the 90s. They've had to modernise the way they do things. So to see modern Russia as similar to Soviet Russia or Tsarist Russia is simply wrong. It's a modernised country. And the Chinese have modernised as well in their own way. They're in a chaotic state at the end of the Cultural Revolution. They'd gone off away with the fairies, marched off in a completely ridiculous direction. And they've come back. But historically, in the big historical sweep, China has always been the dominant power long before the West was. And that's how they think in these terms. You know, we are going to be the dominant power in the 21st century. And I can't see there's anything to stop them short of nuclear war.
But look, David, I mean, anyone looking at this surely can see that Russia is actually quite an interventionist and becoming a dangerous, aggressive power. They've been intervening, for example, down in Syria, in the civil war down in Syria. They've now intervened in the civil war in Ukraine. They came over here to Salisbury in order to poison some of the people who the MI6 were looking after, former Russians. I mean, they are getting very aggressive themselves. I mean, you're painting a picture of the Americans doing all the aggression, but actually it's the Russians, isn't it?
Did any of those things that you just said happen?
I mean, yes.
No, I mean, look, what they did, there was no civil war in Syria. There was an attempted regime change by the US, France, and the UK.
Syrian Army and ISIS. That was right. A civil war, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't a civil war. No, it was a regime change
ISIS
campaign.
ISIS were mostly from outside the country.
Regime change campaign by the West, by the UK, France, and the US. And the Russians defended the Syrian government, and the Syrian government's now won. And the same is true in relation to Ukraine. I mean, you know, the NATO backed them into a corner. They've intervened in order to stop the mass killing in Donbass, which you mentioned. 80% of the civilians, 80% of the people on the civilians killed were from the Donbass, killed by the Ukrainian military, and including the Nazis within it. And what we're seeing in the Ukraine is that the Russians are going to win. I mean, it's perfectly plain that they're going to win. I mean, we've had undiluted propaganda for the last 2 months about Russian incompetence, about their tanks not working, about morale.
Well, apparently Putin is about to kill them.
And Putin smells funny. And, I mean, on the poisoning of Abramovich in the peace negotiations, which was dreamt up by Bellingcat, which is an MI6 contractor. And CIA contractor. I mean, there's a huge avalanche of propaganda about the Ukraine, which many people are believing, including many people on the left, and believing that somehow we have to stand with Ukraine.
Are you telling me that the whole business in Salisbury was all propaganda too? These guys did not try and poison anybody?
Which guys?
The two agents that came over from Russia someone in the centre of Salisbury.
They're not agents. They didn't come from Russia to poison anyone, and they didn't poison anyone. None of that happened. I mean, this is a joke. I mean, it's like Navalny. I mean, it's as if the Russians poisoned Navalny.
What have we heard? What is it? I mean, hang on, because if you have been watching the television, reading your newspaper, there were two Russians that came over.
Yes.
And poisoned Sergei and Yulia Skripal, who were former connected with the Russian secret services, but they were being looked after here in Britain by our own secret services. And they tried to kill them here. I mean, you're saying that didn't happen?
The Russians didn't do it, no.
So what happened?
Well, we don't know exactly what happened, but I mean, certainly they were poisoned with something, and then they were discovered, weren't they, by this young girl who got a prize for her first aid work. She discovered them beside the duck pond. And she was the daughter, wasn't she, of the chief nurse of the British Army, who just happened to be passing as they passed out on the bench. This is a put up job. Who knows what the role of the British intelligence services has been in this? But it's certainly they were neither poisoned by the Novichok, whatever that's supposed to be.
It was in a perfume bottle, apparently.
That was the other Novichok.
Allegedly discovered later. I mean, honestly, does anyone believe that?
I'm afraid lots of people do. I don't, obviously. You know, an obvious thing to point out, there was a letter to the Times the next week from the people running the hospital in Salisbury saying nobody has been treated for nerve agents in this hospital. Nobody.
Well, one person that has very strong opinions about all this sort of thing is a lovely chap from Germany who emigrated to, his family emigrated to the United States by the name of Henry Kissinger. He managed to work his way up to become Secretary of State under Nixon for the Republicans back in the 1970s during the Vietnam War. And he's just brought a book out called Leadership. And we're going to be hearing some clips from the BBC's James Naugherty's interview with him. Happened earlier this week. And I'd just like you two both to tell us what you make of what Kissinger has to say, because he has a curious way of spinning history to try and paint himself out to be someone who's a bit of a hero. And, of course, in Vietnam, he has faced a lot of criticism since for conducting a secret bombing campaign for the United States in Laos and in Cambodia. So here is James Naugherty talking to Henry Kissinger about that era in the 1970s. Here is Henry Kissinger talking about Vietnam specifically and his role in that war and his role in the illegal bombing of Laos and Cambodia in order to apparently bring the end to the war.
Henry Kissinger, the diplomatic go-between and advisor to American presidents since John F. Kennedy, is in his 100th year. This is James Naugherty, and I've been to Henry Kissinger's home in New England in the United States to talk about his new book, Leadership, and about some of the leaders he's known. Despite winning the Nobel Prize for reaching a peace agreement, the most controversial part of his career was over the American war in Vietnam and the extension of the conflict into neighboring Cambodia. He has never wavered in his argument that it was necessary for the United States to expand the war in order to end it.
The war in Vietnam presented itself to Nixon as 500,000 American troops already being in place and 50,000 in the pipeline when he became president, with 30,000 casualties having already been suffered. And the debate in America had become so embittered that President Johnson couldn't appear in public except on military pages. A significant part of the American elite had become convinced that a defeat was better for the American soul than a continuation of the war.
One of the consequences of that was, of course, that the administration felt it couldn't tell Congress about what was going on across the border in Cambodia and Laos. Do you regret that now?
That was a mistake.
They should have been told.
The reaction would have been the same. It was naive to believe that you could conduct a clandestine military operation.
Well, I mean, it did come out because of the Pentagon Papers that exposed, which was leaked by,
Daniel Ellsberg.
Ellsberg. I don't suppose he'd have said, I mean, I don't suppose Kissinger, if it hadn't leaked out, Kissinger would have been quite happy to keep it secret, I think. He talks the language that he used, that a significant part of the elite thought that a defeat would be better for the American soul. And that's very tendentious. You could just say, we're going home. We're not saying we're defeated. You know, if you put all your cards in and say, we've got to fight to the finish here, well, you could have just said, well, we're not really that interested in this, we're going home. And it's, you don't have to spin it as a defeat.
I mean, he was ordering the bombing of Cambodia and Laos at the time in the hope that it would never come out, wasn't he?
Well, no, I think he was doing it because it was part of their extension of the war to intimidate the Chinese, coming back to the kind of things that these people think like. And, of course, ultimately, at the end of that, Kissinger and Nixon go to China and talk to Mao and agree that Taiwan is definitely not going to get the United Nations seat for China and so on.
Well,
so, I mean, Kissinger is, you know, he sees himself as this kind of master of all he surveys. But, of course, you know, lots of people die as they play these games.
Some people have talked about Vietnam as largely about opiates and about the control of the growing of heroin.
Well, that certainly was part of it. The Hmong were used...
Because it was the French there before, wasn't it?
Yeah, the French were there before, but the role of the CIA in the drugs trade goes back to the 1940s, when they were trying to get the nationalists, that Congress in the US was still, a fairly robust democracy in those days in the US. And they were saying, well, we don't want to fund a civil war in China. We're not interested in it. And, of course, the deep state said, well, you've got, you know, we can't have this. So they then said, the light bulb goes on, OK, we can fund it through heroin. And, of course, the Contras in Nicaragua were funded through the cocaine trade and so on. And of course, after a while, it's not a question, is the CIA involved in the drugs trade to get to political goals? It's also that we're a drug dealing empire with a bit of politics on the side. And that's where, you know, all of these things are, you know, underlying all of this.
Then we have Chile. Is the next clip from Kissinger, where he talks about the overthrow of President Allende.
The other thing is the Chilean coup in 1973. Do you regret anything about that? You know, the American engineering, effectively, of a coup to remove a government which you didn't like.
It's always important to remember the context. Allende had come to power through a peculiarity in the constitution, where the party with the largest number of votes, even if it was an overall minority, would be gaining office. But there was an interval between the election and the time that the Congress would act, in which the Chilean parliament would choose the president. So we were trying to influence that election, which American administrations had done periodically. That was not an invention of Nixon. The coup occurred 4 years later. We were not involved in the coup directly.
But there was indirect American involvement. You say nothing direct, but...
Yeah, but we were not in the coup period itself. We did not deplore Allende's overthrow. We were very satisfied with it. And we supported Pinochet after he had established himself.
It was an authoritarian state with a different kind of name about it.
No question, authoritarian state.
David, what do you make of that? You're actually laughing at that point where you said we were not involved in the coup.
Directly.
Long pause. Directly. What do you make of Kissinger's take on that? Because he was central, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, you know, he's unable to face the truth of... his crimes, isn't it? I mean, in both of those clips there, he, you know, as the song from the great Bristol band, the pop group, had it, you know, Nixon and Kissinger should have been tried for war crimes for the secret bombing of Cambodia. I mean, Kissinger is a serial war criminal and should be in prison or have been executed for his crimes. But, you know, here he is as the great master statesman with a soft piano in the background, the footage of the people in Chile saying... the people were united will never be defeated, but that, you know, it's off stage. I mean, this is a joke. I mean, this is a guy who is treated with the respect he doesn't deserve, and as if he is some kind of, you know, interesting commentator who we might push a little bit about whether he got to something a little bit.
Well,
naughty.
I think he was doing quite a good job, I thought, James Naughty there. He's pushing away.
It's polite BBC rubbish. I mean, these people should not be treated like that. They should be treated like war criminals, because that's what they are.
So then we have we move up much to much closer times. I mean, I can't help but admire the BBC for doing some of these interviews. I can remember, hang on, this is probably not late 1990s when Kissinger was being interviewed by Jeremy Paxman. He was asking similar questions again and again about these various interventions around the world, the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, the coup in Indonesia, these things which have had horrific ramifications for decades, ever since those times. And Kissinger walked out of the studio. He wasn't going to take any more. And I think James was asking some of those similar questions
And when Corbyn was asked about his relationships with the Russians, was there gentle piano music playing in the background? No, there wasn't.
No, there wasn't.
Ridiculous.
No. But it's not James Naughty's job to slap the handcuffs on Kissinger, is it? He's got to ask him some awkward questions, and he was doing it, and he carried on doing it, actually, talking about Russia and Ukraine now.
When Kissinger spoke recently about how a deal with Russia might emerge, he was accused of promoting a sellout. President Zelensky of Ukraine even compared him to the appeasers of Nazi Germany. Friends say that, not surprisingly, that reference to Munich, the agreement in the very year that the Kissinger family left Germany, upset him. So for BBC World Service, I asked him to clarify his view.
What we are seeing in Ukraine right now is something peculiar to this period, namely that two nuclear powers with the capacity to incinerate the region are fighting with the personnel of a European state, and that the limits, therefore, are not fully established by them. And secondly, that the war has implications, that at the beginning of wars there's often great unanimity, but when the implications are fully faced, divisiveness appears. And then, how do you relate war aims to a conclusion? I thought that if the status quo ante were reached, it would have been demonstrated that an attack on an existing European entity by resistance of its people, aided by other Europeans and Americans, had been thwarted geographically. This means that that territory that Ukraine controlled when the war started would be restored, and that's about 95%. The other 5% were acquired by Russia 10 years earlier by European acquiescence. And I think it is important to keep the war about freedom of Ukraine from becoming a war about the security of Russia.
But there are many European leaders who say Putin must not be allowed to get away with it. And they might say, here you are, Henry Kissinger. You're saying, in the end, let's make sure that Putin is not humiliated, because that is more important.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying I believe that Putin's position in Russia will be very precarious and probably not maintainable over a substantial period of time. I think that most European leaders that I know, in my opinion, agree with what I said. Putin cannot think he got away with anything if his objective to subjugate the Ukraine has been defeated. Europe acted in unison. Ukraine has been established as a viable European state. Northern Europe has been unified inside NATO. And the argument about whether Ukraine should be part of NATO has been practically resolved, because there's no way of going back to that position.
In that sense, you're suggesting that it has been all but settled.
No, I think if the war is ended on the present line, and therefore most of Donbass and much of the Black Sea coast remains Russian, that in the end it will be perceived as a Russian success. So I would consider that a defeat. I would think if that happened, so that the new dividing line is at the limit of the current Russian advance, That would be a very unfortunate.
So they need to be pushed back further, in your view?
They have to be pushed back to the borders that they had before. That would be a defeat for Russia. Russia would have been diminished in that sense. But the key, in my mind, would then be now a dialogue between Europe, NATO, and Russia might establish a stable system.
Is that possible with Putin still in power?
I don't believe Putin will be in power when that evolves, partly because of longevity in office. This is the objective I would seek, even if Putin were in power, but it's not what I would prefer.
So that's Henry Kissinger speaking this week from his home in New England to James Naughtie at the BBC World Service about his new book, Leadership, which apparently he's an expert on. They're talking about the Ukraine conflict. Martin, he seems to have wrote back, doesn't he? About 3 weeks ago, there was an announcement. Kissinger said that the Ukrainian government is going to have to make concessions to Putin and sign a peace deal sometime soon. But he's now not saying that. He's now saying, as we just heard, they need to push back to the border, otherwise Putin will see this as a victory. So he's changed his position. Why do you think that is?
Well, what he originally said was, they've got to negotiate something within the next 2 months, because if that doesn't happen, then, you know, in other words, there is a rational policy somewhere in the Western powers. You know, the French and the Germans helped to underpin the Minsk agreements in 2015. And the governments of Ukraine agreed to the Minsk agreements in 2015, they were told that they had to negotiate with the separatists. And they did that because they'd lost the war on the ground. And there is some criticism within Russia and within the breakaway republics that we were winning then. And if we were allowed to carry on, we could have liberated the whole of the territory and that would have been the end of it. Yeah. But because of the trying to be nice to the West, the United Russia regime, let's call it that, because Putin is just a figurehead, really. He may die tomorrow, but there will still be the same people in charge. It's a team game. If they'd done that, then the whole thing could have been resolved in 2015. And of course the Russians waited and waited and waited and said, look, come on, negotiate. And there were no negotiations. Before the special military operation, all negotiations had ended for years. Zelensky was elected on the mandate of I will negotiate with the Russians. And that's why the Russians were again waiting. Come on, then negotiate with us. And they only started negotiating when the Russians intervened.
Okay, so 24th of May, Henry Kissinger said Ukraine should concede territory to Russia to end the war. He now seems to have changed his mind, David.
He does. I mean, and it would have ended, as you were saying, it would have ended the war and they would have had Donetsk and Luhansk. Now they've got Donetsk and Luhansk, they've got Zaporizhia, they've got Kherson.
They don't have Donetsk, do they? They have Luhansk
Zaporizhia and Kherson.
No, two-thirds of Donetsk. I sent you that.
They already have Kherson and Zaporizhia and Mykolaiv they're in part of. Quite a lot of Kharkov. I mean, there's five other provinces or oblasts, as they're called, in the Ukraine. Which
but they won't withdraw from those, might they?
Now, the problem with withdrawing, as we saw at Bucha, when they withdraw from an area, the SBU, the Ukrainian secret police, and the Nazis come in and take retaliation against anybody in the local population.
That's true, but I don't think that's the reason that they won't withdraw. I mean, I think the reason they withdrew was so that they could bring the Ukrainians out of their defences around Kharkov and spend a month decimating them, and they never intended to attack Kharkov in the first place. No, that's right.
I mean, but of course, if you're going to go to a war with a country, you attack the capital city because that's what you do.
I mean, the Russians had a strategy, and of course, you know, all of the propaganda we have here is the Russians don't know what they're doing, and they tried to take Kiev and they couldn't, they tried to take Kharkov and they couldn't. No. On the contrary, I mean, they've, as Scott Ritter has repeatedly said, you know, they have played this militarily brilliantly.
And also, of course, they've learned from what they did in Syria, which is a very slow grind. If you're going to save the civilian population, where you've got ISIS in control of a town or something, and they're holding the civilian population as hostages, you can't just waste the town. That's what the Americans did in Raqqa.
That's right.
That's what they did in Fallujah. But that's not the way the Russians fight. And, of course, the Russians are actually, when they intervene in Syria, they do it right. They do it for the long haul and they win. We just rush in where angels fear to tread in Afghanistan, Libya, wherever, and then deal with the consequences afterwards when it's become clear that we haven't got a strategy.
So who's been leaning on Kissinger? Anybody? Why has he changed his mind?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, you know, the interesting thing about Kissinger
is he floating out these ideas maybe just to see how people react and playing with us a bit.
I don't think so. I mean, I think we should remember that Kissinger has many crimes to his name, right? But he was never a neoconservative. He was always a realist in terms of international politics. And that, and the, his statement, his initial statement on Ukraine, is simply a realist statement. It's not a neocon statement. And, you know, the neocons don't like that kind of thing. And he fought with him before, you know, and maybe he's rowing back because of particular reasons.
He's been leaned on enormously by all of his mates. You know, you can't say stuff like that. You're undermining.
Well, not least of which is Zelensky immediately had a go at
it. That's right. But it's the same with John Mearsheimer. You know, I mean, again, he's a realist, well-known, well-regarded political scientist. That, you know, he's not a leftist, but he's come out with very similar stuff. His famous speech has been viewed, I don't know how many thousand times it's been viewed on YouTube now, but it's perfectly plain to these people, to you know, Kissinger, Mearsheimer, Scott Ritter, all of whom are on the right, you know, the Russians were backed into a corner. Everybody can see this.
The final clip we've got with Henry is looking at China and Taiwan.
The president said the United States was willing to use force to defend Taiwan against any Chinese aggression. China responded to the president's
comments. To look at another problem which is not burning at the moment, but is smouldering, we go back to China and Taiwan. What lies ahead for Taiwan?
The essence of the Taiwan relationship is set for Chinese. Taiwan is an inextricable part of the Chinese system. So when we re-establish relations, on the one hand, we accepted the concept of one China, and on the other hand, the Chinese accepted a long period of evolution, which Mao described as even 100 years. So how to handle this period? And in my opinion, which is not the accepted opinion, constant confrontations over Taiwan have the exact opposite effect, because the more we affirm Taiwan as a second China, and the more the Chinese feel they have to reply to that, and the more armed forces are built up around it, the more tense the situation becomes. Neither country should be asked to give up its basic principle explicitly. America has made clear that a violent attack on Taiwan would mean significant American reaction.
It would mean war.
But to answer this question, the way it was done publicly recently is exactly what may produce the situation. If one could cool the rhetoric and watch the actions, if military action takes place, then we have a decision to make, which must be overwhelmingly influenced by what has gone on. But if Taiwan becomes a subject of domestic intense interest in both countries explicitly, the tension can only get worse.
So reading between the lines, I think, David, it's fair to say Kissinger seems to be more concerned about Taiwan than almost anywhere else, actually. I mean, he seems to think there's a Ukraine thing will chug along for a while, but he's saying if the Chinese do move on Taiwan, that will be it. The Americans will go for it big time.
Well, the Chinese are going for it, aren't they? I mean, ever since Ukraine started, the Chinese have been making noises and saying, well, this is an internal issue. Everyone else can put out. Taiwan is China. Don't be ridiculous. And so I suspect what they'll do is they'll take it shortly. I mean, we're now in a period, as everyone now knows in that side of the world, of declining American dominance, and there's nothing the Americans can do about it.
And do you think maybe that President Xi and his friends are looking at what the Russians have done in Ukraine and saying, well, if they can do it, so can we?
Absolutely, they're saying that. No, it's not just that the threat of the good example, if you like, but that they've recognised that the unipolarity is withering and that multipolarity is having its day. So I think that the calculations in China, if you look at everything they've been saying since February, it's perfectly plain that they're going to do something soon.
Martin?
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think Kissinger basically saying that, because he agreed with Mao and Chou En-lai that Taiwan would not be recognised by the US as the voice of China. Yeah. And, of course, within Taiwan itself, the Kuomintang, who were mostly people who'd come over from the mainland, they were the ones who were pushing that. And the locals were saying, well, actually, we don't particularly want that either. You know, it doesn't make any sense to us. And there's obviously a solution here, which is to allow Taiwan to be an independent, autonomous region of China. Yeah. And don't forget, there's massive economic links between Taiwan and China. So a lot of, lots of Taiwanese businessmen make lots of good money on the mainland. And there's also, and in the long run, if everybody was being sensible, this would lead to whatever it leads to. But, the idea that you've got to defend the independence of Taiwan, why? Well, it's just a part of China, historically.
But it may be, surely, as the American empire is crumbling and dying, it may be a way of them regaining their credibility by saying we will simply refuse to put up with this.
What Kissinger is hinting at there is, think about the geography. It's a bit the same as the Ukraine. How can the US win a war on the other side of the Pacific against China? It's like the Chinese saying that we're going to take over California. It wouldn't work,
so
would it?
So Americans are going to just suck it up like we had to do in Suez?
Well, I think that's the implication. Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Chinese are going to do it where they calculate that the Americans are going to go into war with them. I mean, I think it's the tendency will be for it to become just part of China, as you're saying.
I mean, yeah, but I think the Chinese are not taking a warlike approach. They've trained to take it. Yeah, that's what they've got. They've got all the stuff there to take it if they want to. But it would be a very destructive thing to do, They could, one of the easy things that the Americans could do is they could just allow Taiwan to be wrecked in the fighting, which is no use to anybody. And that's the problem in the Ukraine. But in the Ukraine, the Russians have carried on supplying gas to the Ukrainians throughout the crisis, even though they haven't paid for years, because they're not, in fact, trying to destroy Ukrainian society. They're their neighbours, for goodness sakes. They're going to have to live with them forever, just like the English and the Irish or whatever it is.
Anyway, I know we're a bit over time, David, and you want to get going, but we can't let you go without saying something about the grey zone, because you're actually the headlines, and you have been for a few days now, on the grey zone with an A, greyzone.com, with Max Blumenthal runs it, and there's an article up here on the front page here saying how the UK's intelligence services target dissident academics. Now, I suppose if we were sitting around the studio in Newsnight, someone would be saying to you, you're just a conspiracy theorist. The intelligence services weren't targeting you. Where's your evidence?
Well, the evidence is in the emails. I mean, this is an extraordinary leak. Just let me just remind your listeners that these are leaked emails showing Paul Mason, the famous left-wing journalist, sort of sometime supporter of Corbyn and then opponent of Corbyn.
Yes, and I knew him as a father of chapel for the Newsnight journalists in the National Union of Journalists.
And I met him for the first time in 2005 on the Glen Eagles demonstration against the G8, and he then helped me to get on Newsnight in 2007, where I had a bit of a joust with Paxman over the BBC's appalling coverage of Iraq. So he was a comrade of mine, and so some years later, 14 years later, he's writing emails to this guy, Andy, who is as he put it when this was all leaked, was a confidential source of his. Well, no, on the contrary, this is a guy who wasn't giving him information for journalistic stories. He was supplying information to this guy, which could then be checked out by this guy's mates. And this guy, Andy Price, is an MI6 officer. So he is an agent in the classical definition used by MI6 of what an agent is. Paul Mason is an agent of MI6, and he's being handled. Andy Price is his handler. So when we see this through the emails, we see there's been a connection between Mason trying to set up a successor to the Integrity Initiative, which is a Foreign Office project to counter Russian disinformation.
Basically, to try and change the name or get rid of that one name and create something new that no one knew about.
And of course, Andy Price was also in charge of the Integrity Initiative back in 2018.
Do you want to just say something about who they were and what they were up to?
So this was a project run by the Institute for Statecraft, a charity and a think tank, which was funded by the Foreign Office, and it was the intent was to counter Russian disinformation. But of course, it spent most of its time countering Jeremy Corbyn and attacking Jeremy Corbyn. So this is a government-funded project attacking the leader of the opposition, which of course is contrary to all the rules and regulations. It was based in this Institute for Statecraft, which had its registered office was in Scotland, right? So it's registered with the office of the Scottish Charity Regulator, not with the Charity Commission. And its office, registered office, was a derelict mill in Fife. And remember, Chris Williamson went up there and stood outside, you know, filmed himself saying, what is this? And so this is a really dodgy organisation. It was set up and funded by the Foreign Office, overseen by this guy, Andy Price, from MI6, and run by guys who were from military intelligence. An honorary major in military intelligence, Chris Donnelly, ran the project. And six put in their own guy, this guy, Guy Spindler, the former bureau chief of MI6 in Warsaw, to make sure that the military intelligence people didn't duff it up too much. And, of course, they totally duffed it up. And what happened then was we all complained to the Office of the Scottish Charity Regulator, and they said, you can't be a charity and have a public benefit and be working directly for the Foreign Office. It's not appropriate. So the whole thing collapsed. So now we come to Mason trying to set up a successor, and they're very clear in the emails that they want to set this up in a way which will not be seen as an intelligence operation, because our opponents are clever. They'll see that this is an intelligence operation, so we have to make it very, very sneaky, and we'll have this international information brigade. So he's talking there with his MI6 contact, and he reports people he meets. There's a guy he met at a demonstration. They did a demonstration in favour of the war, organised by the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. Mason was there, and this guy, Michael Tracy, he's on Twitter, comes up and confronts him, and Mason says, off, tells him to go away. So sorry about the language. And what then happens is Mason goes home, he gets on his email, and he writes to MI6 and says, is this guy Tracy? We need to find out who's pulling his strings. And so he's asking MI6 to investigate people who have criticised him in a demonstration. Absolutely extraordinary. Now, to come to the question you posed about me, he says, yes, it's the far-left rogue academics I'm after. They're the people who questioned chemical attacks in Syria. That's me. Or and then who started...
Oh, hang on, it's not just you. It's not just half me. Half the world was doing it.
And also who say that anti-Semitism in the Labour Party was a scam. That's me. And then the ones who questioned Butcher. Also me. So the people he's talking about is the Syria Media Propaganda Working Group, of which I'm a member and others are members. So he's talking about quite a small collection of people who he's specifically targeting. That's extraordinary.
It's not just you, is it? It's also Piers Robinson, who's actually quite well known. We've had clips of him every few months or whatever on this programme. Isn't he a professor of propaganda studies? Is he still in his job? Has he been targeted like you have been?
Well, we've all been targeted. He and there's two of us at Edinburgh University, we've all been targeted. Piers now lives in Berlin. He's not in an academic job anymore. I'm not in an academic job anymore. Tim at Edinburgh is under attack and is being, you know, complained about, and they're trying to get him out of his job. So there's all, you know, this is a serious attempt to target anyone who raises questions about British foreign policy in Syria and in relation to Ukraine.
What
as well.
I find so extraordinary is that this is something that MI6 are up to. I mean, they're supposed not to operate domestically. They're supposed to be a foreign intelligence service. These are the James Bond style characters who are abroad. They're actually supposed to be gathering intelligence abroad. abroad, maybe bumping people off abroad that are trying to wage war on Britain.
They are doing that. That's right. Yeah, but they no. But I mean, of course. But I mean, I don't know why they're wasting taxpayers' money trying to target.
Maybe it's easier to go for you who do
empirical research.
It's easier to go for you than it is to take the Russians on.
Well, on the contrary, I mean, if you look at what they've done in Syria, I mean, there's a huge operation in Syria, overseen by this guy Price, with a huge number of PR firms, of NGOs, of doctors' organisations, all funded by MI6, and all many of them, in fact, are run by people who are ex-MI6, including, of course, the White Helmets, a group called ARC, a group called the Centre for International Justice and Accountability. All of these are Britain's cat's paw in Syria, trying to undermine the regime and support the alleged resistance.
It's pretty shocking to think that the British public money is going on in these clandestine operations. Is there anything we can do to fight back other than just publish and get the information out there? Because it doesn't seem as if there's a very much of a legal address. You're fighting the secret state here.
Well, we're fighting the secret state. That's true, but I mean, the debate has to be had, and the information that we've been able to find. I mean, in the case of Syria, we wrote a briefing paper on the Douma attack in 2018, and as a result of that, from inside the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, we got leaked documents showing that we were absolutely onto something, and that the inspectors who'd gone to Douma to examine what happened there had concluded that it was a fake, but that their report had been censored at the behest of unidentified American intelligence agents.
One of the things that we've been getting a lot on Channel 4 News and the rest of them is these White Helmets. Almost everything that happens, these guys appear. I believe, Martin, you were talking about this guy, James Le Mesurier, who was supposed to be running it all. And he had a nasty accident of some sort, David, didn't he? I mean, what happened with that? Because that's a bizarre turn of events, that the guy that's put in charge of this propaganda organisation, so the idea is that they were supposed to be going in to rescue people. What actually they were doing was massaging and faking footage and that sort of thing for the British press to make it look as if, the Syrians had been behind an attack,
right,
for example, when actually it was ISIS and it was the Western-backed people who were behind these attacks. So what happened to this guy, James Limiter? He's no longer with us, is he?
No, he's not. I mean, he was military intelligence. He wasn't six. And he ran this organisation. He married this woman who'd been involved in another MI6 front group in Syria called Emma. And they were in their flat in Turkey. He had written some emails the previous week admitting responsibility for a large-scale fraud in the organisation. Money had gone missing. And then he was very agitated, according to his wife, that night. And she took some sleeping pills and she slept through him falling from the roof of their apartment. And he fell from the roof in such a way that he landed, he banged into the wall on the other side of the road. So there must have been some kind of
jump, quite a large jump.
Was
there a strong wind blowing, hundred miles an hour wind?
No, it wasn't. So there's something very odd there. And when the police arrived, there were piles of cash all along the hall in their apartment. So, I mean, something very odd happened there. We don't know if he killed himself or if he was frightened or something. It's not clear. But certainly what led to it was the unravelling of this project. He had admitted to fraud. And there had been internal investigations in European parliaments who'd also funded them, which had revealed that there was fraud inside the organisation.
Crikey. Well, a bit of a sting in the tail. Thank you very much for coming along to share your thoughts with us, David. And what about if people want to follow you, social media, or support you in whatever way?
So I was banned from Twitter for 2.5 years. I'm back on Twitter now. My Twitter handle is tracking_power. And my name, David Miller, so you can follow me there, or spinwatch.org.
What about donating? Because, you're involved in various causes here, aren't you?
So, I mean, you can sponsor our research on spinwatch.org. You can donate money to it there. And you can also, I should have mentioned, I was sacked by the University of Bristol. I'm taking them to Industrial Tribunal, and I need money to support that cause. So there's a website, supportmiller.org, where you can help me to raise enough money to defend myself at the Industrial Tribunal.
Nice one. Anyway, thanks very much, David Miller, for joining us today. And we've got another little bit of Henry Kissinger, which we'll be good to get Martin to comment on, which is just as the interview with James Naugherty winds up, and he talks about who it was that he met on the doorstep of Henry Kissinger as James Naugherty was leaving. Who was coming in?
The confrontational aspect of international affairs, which is prerequisite to the ability to do anything else, has become inconceivably dangerous and in some respects out of control even of leaders, and one needs a conceptual approach how both to be strong but to conduct a serious dialogue. The view that the whole world is uniformly going to share the same notion of legitimacy has not been proved by events, and it's even harder to prove in the future. What I said in this book is a recognition that decoupling is happening, both philosophically and economically and in the way of conduct. But paradoxically, what we are now asking of leaders, or what the situation asks of leaders, is that they are wise in seemingly antithetical concepts, and we have no training in that.
Democracy and autocracy are bound to have to live side by side.
I'm not saying autocracy must always survive. I'm just saying that among democracies, the confrontational aspect is at least reduced, if not eliminated. But a realistic assessment of where the world is going, they will have to live side by side for the rest of this century in some way. And for that, a new mentality has to be created. Not between those who want peace and others who want war, but between those who are prepared to defend, but also prepared to accommodate within the limits that their values permit. That's very hard to achieve because it means that within each country you need enough confidence in each other so that you can live with decisions because you have confidence that over a long period of time the society will hold together.
Countries need confidence in each other to survive together. That's the never-ending quest that has been the theme of a life, in times of war and occasional peace. This time next year, Henry Kissinger will be 100. Leaving him in his library, a leafy New England scene spreading out around us, he was getting ready for lunch with the Chinese ambassador and his retinue. A diplomat to the end.
Well, that's James Naugherty speaking to Henry Kissinger earlier this week, and I think did a reasonably good job. Kissinger's book is called Leadership, and I'll put a link up to the full, I think it's 50 minutes or so, interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Just get your head around what Henry's thinking. I find it fascinating, Martin, and also interesting that, you know, as he comes out, he bumps into the Chinese ambassador and his retinue coming in to see Kissinger. I mean, the guy was in the 1970s was the Secretary of State. Now he's just a private individual.
Well, he's obviously a very powerful private individual with very powerful connections. I think overall what's interesting about Kissinger compared to the current people running the show is that he has in fact got some grasp on reality, whereas of course people pushing for further sanctions on Russia and to provoke the Chinese about Taiwan basically are overgrown school
kids. But he doesn't sound like he's really repenting very much for all of those war crimes, Martin.
No, he's not.
He's basically just coming up with excuses and trying to wriggle out of it. He's not a great repenter.
Well, in the famous words of Mandy Rice Davis, he would say that, wouldn't he? He's obviously going to try and get what he's trying to do is get his spin on history. What's it? Churchill said, "History will be kind to me because I'm going to write it." Yeah, that's what people do.
Yeah, I wonder if he'll make it another year, or whether he'll actually get a Third World War started before he dies. Anyway, back to a subject which we were covering halfway through the show, which is the Murdoch Empire. And I came across a brilliant piece, which I'll put a link up to the full show, the full 25 minutes, about by Matt Chorley and Gabriel Pogrand on Times Radio this week. This is their little podcast, they call it. I think it's called The Big Thing. And it's all about Prince Charles. And it's, I think, a fascinating insight into the way things really work in this country, particularly with individuals. And I don't see him as just part of the monarchy, because obviously, you know, you've got the good and the bad within any family, just as you have within the royal family.
A very good morning to you. It's Matt Shirley here on Times Radio.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
The future king is in his counting house, counting all his money. But where does it come from? What do donors expect in return? And just how big a suitcase do you need to hold £1 million in cash? We take a look at Prince Charles's finances this morning. The oldest heir to the throne for almost 300 years and increasingly taking on some of the big duties from the Queen, including just recently in the state opening of Parliament.
My lords and members of the House of Commons, Her Majesty's government's priority is to grow and strengthen the economy and help ease the cost of living for families. Her Majesty's
but with all this increased responsibility comes increased scrutiny of how he operates, including the way money passes through his office and charities. Well, Gabriel Pogrand is the Whitehall editor of the Sunday Times, who's been investigating all of this. And Prince Charles's finances keep ending up on the front page as a result. Morning, Gabriel. Thanks for joining us. What was the trigger of your particular interest in Prince Charles and his finances?
You know what? It all came about by accident, as many of the best stories do. Henry Zeffman and I were looking into the Tory party chairman, Ben Elliott. And readers may recall last year that we did a story revealing that a Tory donor had paid Ben Elliott's company, his concierge business, quintessentially, and off the back of that, booked to go on a private jet up to Charles's beloved estate in Scotland, Dumfries House, and have dinner with the future king. And off the back of this, we got a load of tips from people saying this sort of syndicate where the world's wealthy people can pay fixers or intermediaries and get in a room with HRH, I mean, you haven't even got a fraction of how big and institutionalised this all is. I ended up spending a lot of time poring over hundreds of documents that showed that Charles's closest confidant, the notorious Michael Fawcett, and a load of fixers had secured an honour for this Saudi billionaire. That's now under police investigation, but that was basically our way in. And since then, we've been marinating in the world of royal sleaze, and it makes politics look clean, to be frank.
And so let's work through some of them first of all. So the Saudi tycoon Khalid bin Mahfouz gave £1.5 million to a charity associated with Prince Charles, and then subsequently got CBE. That's now being investigated by the police. Then there was your revelation, a week ago, about this £1 million in a suitcase from Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim, former Prime Minister of Qatar. That's being in the charity, that was a total of £3 million all between 2011 and 2015. They're now saying, oh, that was all in the past, a long time ago.
Half a decade ago, no less.
Yeah. And they definitely wouldn't take money in suitcases now.
If it was a year ago, they'd have said it was a tenth of a decade ago.
And now, just yesterday, another revelation, this time involving Lord Brownlow, who listeners will remember was the guy who offered to pay for the gold wallpaper in number 10. More recently, was being lined up to stump up £150,000 to build a tree house for Boris Johnson at Chequers. Not for Boris Johnson, for his son. Although that name, I mean, you never know.
Key distinction.
You can't rule it out. Explain what's going on with this story. How's Lord Brownlow now moved from politics into the Prince Charles story?
I mean, he's a fascinating man, Lord Brownlow, but he basically has this decade-long pattern of conduct of bailing out extremely powerful and influential but occasionally cash-strapped people. You mentioned the Boris, his relationship with Boris. He also was the white knight that rescued David Cameron's wife Samantha's fashion company when it was hemorrhaging £500,000 a year. He took a 10% stake in that. And then we revealed yesterday he'd also been bailing out Prince Charles. I mean, one of the sort of interesting structural factors over here that people probably wouldn't assume is Charles doesn't have that much money. It was actually in 2007 that he took out a £20 million loan in order to buy Dumfries House. It was going to be bought by an American buyer. Charles said to his friend, the Marquis of Bute, "I'll put together some money, let me save it for the nation." Since then, it's been the sort of headquarters of his philanthropic empire and his weekend estate. But he's basically struggled to pay the debt back ever since. He actually told an ITV documentary in 2012 that the debt kept him up at night. I don't think most people assume the future king spends his nights, in cold sweats thinking about the debt. But Brownlow is one of a number of people alongside the Saudi and HBJ, the former Qatari PM, who he's turned to in order to bail out his actually quite financially troubling situation.
Let's just focus on Dumfries House for a moment. I think we've got a clip. This is Prince Charles speaking to the BBC's Hidden Heritage in 2011 about why he wanted to take on that task of restoring Dumfries House.
When I'd heard about this house, you see, that there was difficulty with it and that they wanted to sell it and find a solution. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. And I remember trying 4 years before it actually came up for sale as a problem, I tried to find a way of seeing if we could help sort it out or find somebody who might help, a sponsor, a donor, whatever. But it was just such an enormous task.
Poor old Prince Charles. Martin, it is, when it comes to the royal family, there seems to be he always seems to be the one that's trying to use the position to do this, that and everything else. He wants his own little secret headquarters up in Scotland, but it all turns bad because he can't really afford it. And all the various schemes he tries to put in place turn out to be potentially criminal in order to finance it.
Well, yes. And of course, Prince Andrew used to travel around the world basically as an arms salesman for British private companies like BAE Systems. It's a nest of corruption, isn't it?
Charles particularly seems to be doing this sort of thing. We'll be hearing some more from that. But if you want to hear, I'll make sure that's up on our show page later this evening at thisweek.org.uk. The full report, an excellent piece of work by these Times Radio people. Again, I find myself, I don't like doing it, but patting Murdoch on the back, saying, you know, this is good investigative journalism. This is the sort of stuff. The BBC have hardly touched this story, but the Sunday Times and Times Radio have done a fantastic job on pulling together all these threads of the various forms of corruption that the so-called future king. It would be rather nice, wouldn't it, if he was considering taking on a bigger role around the world with someone like Klaus Schwab and would get on a plane and not come back.
Well, I'm not going to. I've got no brief for Prince Charles whatsoever, and of course the journalists have done a good job here. Rupert Murdoch, all he's done is allowed them to do that good job.
The BBC won't do it, will they? Because they do everything Prince Charles asked them to do. Like, indeed, for example, ban that fantastic 1995 interview with Princess Diana, that panorama programme. The BBC have been told by Prince Charles and his lawyers, you know, we're never going to see that again. And of course, the BBC just do what they're told. After all, it is an organisation which is constituted under a royal charter.
It is, but of course the BBC, which is obviously, you know, very much dominated by the government of the day and the establishment, is better in some respects than other privately run corporations who have no mandates to tell the truth at all.
I think
they just make it up.
The fact of the matter is, every journalistic outlet has something going for it and something horrifically hobbling about it. So, you know, the idea that, oh, if it's in the Daily Mail, it must be rubbish, is just, I'm afraid, not true. What, as professional people, you have to do is to look around all over and see where the actual truth is. And every publication, almost anywhere, you'll find a little glimmer of truth somewhere. And that's what we try and dig out for you here. So that's what you got. Martin, penultimate story tonight, the Georgia Guidestones. It's called America's Stonehenge, although it's much more recent. At 4 o'clock in the morning earlier on this week, someone decided to blow it up.
Well, I mean, the Georgia Guidestones are part of, you know, conspiracy folklore, because they supposedly, as I understand it, there are some writings on them about how they're trying to reduce the population to a sustainable level.
What they say is, yeah, this is, in fact, it links rather up with Prince Charles. He says that we need three planets in order for the people who are now living to actually live on it. And, of course, that is an assumption that we need to get rid of two-thirds of the world's population, which is actually rather a creepy thing to be just, you know, letting drop, and extremely political when he's supposed to be apolitical. So they say that the Georgia Guidestones say that the world population will only be sustainable when we get down to 500 million people.
Yes, and that's why some people don't like that and they've blown it up, presumably.
Finally, tonight, Vladimir Zelenko, Zev Zelenko, died last week, and I put the full interview up with him last week. But I'd just like to end with him because he's done such an amazing job, this Orthodox Jewish doctor to Donald Trump. And here he is talking about in an interview with Anne van der Steel about what he believes COVID was, a weapon of mass murder and genocide.
I went from a small upstate New York country doctor to dealing with the world state on the world stage. I mean, governments have consulted with me. I'll have to share with you an anecdote, which is amazing, about Honduras. But initially, it was a learning curve how to deal with being vilified on the front page of the New York Times or Washington Post or Vanity Fair put me on the front cover with me on top, President Trump underneath me, and Stephen Hahn, the FDA commissioner, underneath him. And I'm like the Jew who the protocols of the elders of Zion, anti-Semitic literature, showing that I control the world, you know. That type of imaging and narrative was designed to marginalize me, to vilify me, to take away my credibility. And the reason why whoever is doing this in a coordinated fashion, is because my message is actually true. And I'm over target, and they cannot let it get out. But they're not God. And the truth will get out, is getting out. It is out. Now, let me be blunt. There's nothing natural about COVID-19. It's a weapon of mass murder and genocide. We have 20 years of peer-reviewed paper evidence and a patent trail of 20 years that explain and document how a benign animal virus was manipulated by man, actually by Dr. Ralph Baric from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We haven't seen or heard of him in the last 2.5 years. I wonder where he is. And it was designed to infect human beings and destroy human lung tissue. So it was released for that purpose. Now, if you notice, all the treatments that were developed that were effective, whether it was hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or steroids or early intervention, immediately marginalized, vilified. Any doctor advocating for them, deplatformed. You know, in Australia, any doctor, New South Wales, if anyone, any doctor prescribed hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin for COVID-19, went to jail for 6 months. And the government told you why. Mm-hmm. Because you're encouraging vaccine hesitancy.
Right.
Think about that. You know what that means? Let me translate that. It actually works. And since it works, people get better. When they get better, they don't want to take the vaccine. They probably tell their families not to take it either. And because of that, doctors who are actually treating patients properly and saving their lives are being sent to jail. So the whole point of the COVID-19 weapon actually wasn't to massacre people, although that's part of it. It was to generate global psychosis. And what I mean by that, if you create global fear, and then you prevent anything to mitigate that fear, that may give people hope, and you restrict, you know, you suppress that, and you allow for the fear to continue, then you isolate them from their support structure, whether spiritual or family. Then you dehumanize them by putting a face diaper on them. The majority of people psychologically decompensate. That's called mass psychosis. And they become gullible. You can manipulate their behavior. And so then you introduce a false promise, this vaccine. And the only thing this vaccine doesn't do is prevent COVID. And there's a lot of other things, by the way. And by the way, don't believe anything that I'm saying. Trust but verify. I'm just one person. But I have evidence for everything that I'm claiming. I can make that available to the whole world. Do your own due diligence and come to your own conclusions.
So that's the voice of Zev Zelenko, Dr. Zev Zelenko, who was a doctor to Donald Trump, started in New York. And the full version of that is on last week's show at thisweek.org.uk. Rest in peace, Zev Zelenko, who died last week. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, former Professor of Sociology at Bristol University, David Miller, and sound engineer Dave Bazenko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Please do send me interviews, story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics show page or via the actual email address that is on there, which is at thisweekoneword.org.uk, where you can download the full length interviews and the podcast itself, and even donate if you feel so inclined. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperbacks are on thisweek.org.uk as well as bilderberg.org, and they're basically there, links up to eBay to actually buy those paperbacks, along with Bible studies that I also sell there too. The show is repeated at 11 on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. right the way through the week on the PRS stream when it's up. Sorry, it wasn't for a couple of days up until today because the computer got shut down somehow. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at talkradio.org.uk stream. That's talkradio, one word. And also at radioqeuk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Disinformation, military style, is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own some of the transmitters and the printing presses. Not so much at Times Radio and at Talk TV. Elsewhere and all on the BBC World Service, as we heard this week. The glorious Fourth Reich, they are. A bit of a battle going on there for control of those transmitters and printing presses. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show, a live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless you and God bless Zev Zelenko. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Drag you, holly, holly, roll up, holly, holly, roll.